Are you searching for the best in online black radio? Then go to blacktalkradionetwork.com, helping you filter through the noise. Real talk, black talk.
The internet is full of half-truths and all-out lies. We've all seen them, and many people on social media complaining about it. Here's your chance to show improve. WorldAfropedia.com is a black-owned and operated encyclopedia. There are several thousand articles, but we need help. We can't uncover all the truth ourselves. So please, join us and become a writer, editor, or blogger for WorldAfropedia.com today. Every little bit counts. We owe it to the future generations to put the truth out there. Visit WorldAfropedia.com, the African-centered encyclopedia, a global database of African knowledge for the purpose of bringing about global African wisdom and understanding. WorldAfropedia.com.
Now, 50 years ago, they had you upside down with a fucking fork up your ass. You can talk your brain now, motherfucker. Blow his ass out. He's a nigger.
Oh, my God.
A nigger. Look, there's a nigger.
Ooh. And I told him, sir, you're not going to stand on this property. You're going to go or else the next call is the police.
Continuing our team coverage, racist comments got a heckler kicked out of a comedy club in Naples. NBC2's Brian Anderson found out that heckler has now lost his job.
First, the guy couldn't keep quiet during the comedy show. Then he sends an extremely racist Facebook message to the comedian. But what he failed to realize is the power of social media, because it landed him on the unemployment line.
When it comes to comedy shows,
guy kept talking the whole show.
Hecklers come with the territory.
A disruptive customer that wanted to be center of attention during the show.
But Off the Hook comedy club owner Brian Spina says what happened Saturday night went too far.
It's highly inappropriate. We have no place for it. And I think that some of the things probably he had coming to him.
He is Joseph Lanham, a Fort Myers man there to see comedian Gary Owen.
I was doing a Trump joke and he said, yeah, there's more of us than there is of them. And he kept talking. So I kicked him out of my show.
The racial language didn't stop there. Owen says he received a Facebook message from Lanham using the N-word.
I would read it, but I'm not allowed. Now everybody knows who you are. Hope your boss sees it if you got a job.
Lanham was fired from his job as vice president of sales for National Roofing of Collier.
It angers you. There's no call for it.
Ralph Goddard is one of the owners, telling me his company has received threats of violence from Lanham's choice of words.
I was fearful for my employees to even come in this morning, because I didn't know what to expect.
He also fired Lanham's wife. Lanham told me off camera he's not racist, blaming alcohol for his behavior.
He sent me an apology. I said he was drunk, but I don't know if I accept it yet, because a drunken tongue speaks a sober mind.
Lanham refused an on-camera interview today. He said he and his wife now have to carry guns for their safety and that they're selling their house and moving out of state because of this furious fallout from his racist remarks. In the control room, Brian Anderson, NBC2.
I don't want us to lose sight that things are getting better. Each successive generation seems to be making progress in changing attitudes when it comes to race. Doesn't mean we're in a post-racial society. It doesn't mean that racism is eliminated. But you know, when I talk to Malia and Sasha, and I listen to their friends and I see them interact, they're better than we are. They're better than we were on these issues. And that's true in every community that I've visited all across the country.
Written in chalk, words like racism will not be tolerated cover the pavement outside the Black Engineering Building on Iowa State's campus.
It's good to know that we aren't going to accept what is going on here.
A sign of opposition after this picture was taken on the social media app Snapchat. It shows three students in front of the black engineering building with the caption, N-words only. Freshman Kyle Malaker snapped the photo on Tuesday. Channel 13 tried reaching him for comments, but did not hear back. Malaker told the Iowa State Daily newspaper he's an engineering student and said the post was meant to be, quote, funny, before choosing to delete it.
When you make a comment, you make a comment, and a lot of times you really do intend for it to be that way.
The engineering building is named after this man, Henry M. Black, a white man who helped advance the university's mechanical engineering program.
I was really surprised to see all this happening.
Freshman civil engineering student Bailey Irvin calls the student's use of the N-word ignorant and hurtful.
I personally don't even like to use it. It's just so strong, you know, and people like to play around with it all the time.
Irvin had hoped her time at Iowa State would be spent in an inclusive environment. Now she's beginning to think otherwise.
I'm already nervous about classes, and I know that I'm probably going to be one of the only female black students in most of my classes. So, yeah, it's a lot to deal with.
The racially charged post isn't just disturbing students of color.
A university like this, 36,000 students, is a place of diversity, and we should all support each other in that.
Some now calling for the students who posted this picture to face disciplinary action or even expulsion.
I would like to see more than just a written statement. I feel like just a written statement is not going to do it.
But a statement is what the university issued, saying in part the social media post containing a slur was racist, thoughtless, and hurtful. It goes on to say, we value all of our students. As a part of our new student onboarding, we will reinforce diversity, inclusion, and teach and demonstrate our principles of community. We are also working to improve our student onboarding to address campus climate issues. The university's Dean of Students Office says it spent the day meeting with the students involved in the post to figure out if their intention was that of harassment. If so, they could face some type of disciplinary action. Aaron.
In Hollywood, Florida, three street names are the latest flashpoint of racial tensions. Protesters are calling for the streets named for Civil War-era generals to be changed, but they're meeting resistance from white supremacy groups and some local residents.
The people that are for changing the names are racist. Those that want to keep their street names are not racist. This is not a race issue, and we don't want to be made a racial issue.
Civil rights activists say what's happening here is part of a much wider problem. A map compiled by one organization has tracked a dramatic rise in hate groups. Florida is home to more than 60.
It crosses education lines, class lines.
Professor Osamudia James says the group's members come from a cross-section of socioeconomic backgrounds, but are part of a bigger issue.
White supremacy is segregated neighborhoods. White supremacy is segregated school buildings. White supremacy is the lack of people of color in your personal and professional spaces. And that architecture, which is much more palatable and seems much more innocent, is what can support the less palatable elements that we're looking at now.
But I'm an American-American. And some of the things I see in this country of ours make my blood boil.
In the last few days, this film, Warning of the Dangers of Fascism, has been widely shared on social media. It was made in 1947, but resonates with many now. Holocaust memorials are scattered throughout the city, a stark reminder to its residents of where extremism can lead. Others in the social justice community say the president's rhetoric isn't helping with the current situation. Meena Jagannath is the co-founder of the Community Justice Project in Miami and fights for racial justice.
It seems like if given a choice, he would rather not name them and he would rather not condemn them because in many ways that's his base, you know, and he doesn't want to, you know, erode the sort of galvanizing power that his, you know, coming to the presidency has created.
In Charlottesville, the so-called Unite the Right march became a coalition of white nationalists, neo-Nazis and the Ku Klux Klan. These are groups based across the country, united online and more active than they've been in decades. Andy Gallagher, Al Jazeera, Miami, Florida.
Ferguson is just outside St. Louis, Missouri, the place where, as historian Blair Kelly reminded us this week in The Root, Dred Scott sued for his freedom on the grounds that he and his wife had for many years lived in a free state. His case eventually went to the Supreme Court, and in 1857, Chief Justice Roger Taney declared that Scott had no right to sue because, as a black man, he was never intended to be an American. Speaking on the clause in the Declaration of Independence that all men are created equal, Taney wrote, quote, "It is too clear for dispute that the enslaved African race were not intended to be included and formed no part of the people who framed and adopted this declaration." And he went on to say that black men had no rights which the white man was bound to respect. No rights which the white man was bound to respect.
The statue of former Supreme Court Chief Justice Roger Taney has been hauled away from the grounds of the State House in Annapolis. Crews gathered shortly after midnight to lift the statue from its base and then lower it into a truck and drive it away. Taney is best known for writing the 1857 Dred Scott decision that upheld slavery by denying black people U.S. citizenship. The removal of his statue came after an email vote by the State House Trust Board earlier this week. WYPR's Rachel Bay reports that State Senate President Mike Miller, who sits on that board, has jumped to Taney's defense.
In a letter sent Thursday to Governor Larry Hogan, Miller, the only member of the four-person State House Trust who opposes removing the statue, criticized the decision not to discuss Taney's legacy at a public meeting before voting. Although Taney is best known for a decision that declared that blacks had no, quote, right the white man is bound to respect, Miller noted that he also served in several roles in state and federal government. Taney was U.S. Attorney General and Secretary of the Treasury under President Andrew Jackson. He was the first Catholic justice of the Supreme Court and the only Chief Justice from Maryland. Earlier this week, Baltimore removed a second statue of Taney from its pedestal on Mount Vernon Place. I'm Rachel Bay for 88.1 WYPR.
I watched a white riot in Portland, Oregon on television the other night. News said they did $1 million worth of damage. Every black person was watching that like amateurs.
Senior citizens who are African American are more likely to develop Alzheimer's disease and other dementia than seniors who are white. That has led to an unusual brain health study in North and Northeast Portland in which black seniors walk together and share memories of the vibrant black communities they grew up in and talk about how those communities are gentrifying. It's an exercise in community memory, and it's run by Dr. Raina Croft. She's an assistant professor of neurology at OHSU. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
And Edna White joins us as well. She's been a participant in the study. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
So, Raina Croft, to you first. This is the second phase of this study. Can you tell us how it works and what your subjects do day to day?
Sure. Well, the aim of the study is to increase physical activity, social engagement, and reminiscence. And so the way we do that is we go on neighborhood walks. So we have 21 participants, all African American, age 55 and older, and they have groups of three. And three times a week, they go on a walk that we have given them on a tablet. And at three points along that walk, which is about a mile, they will view three historical images that pop up automatically because it's all connected with GPS. And there are question prompts that get them talking. So this is the conversation piece, the social engagement piece, about the history of the neighborhood. And so they're remembering what was as they're walking through what is.
And the study is called SHARP. It stands for Sharing History Through Active Reminiscence and Photo Imagery. What ideas are you testing in the study?
Well, we know that social engagement is good for brain health. Okay, when you're talking with someone, you're listening, you're engaging parts of your brain, you're thinking of what you want to say next, you're judging what you want to say, what you don't want to say, and all this is cognitive stimulation. We know that physical activity is good for brain health, and we often think of our health from the neck down, cardiovascular health, but being physically active is good for for the brain as well, and reminiscence. So all of these have been tested individually, and we're hoping to find out what happens collectively when we join these modalities.
Can you speak a little bit more about the reminiscence piece of it? Because it's, I think, easy for listeners to imagine that, yes, walking and talking with your friends, all of that is good for your sense of well-being. But what is the role of reminiscence in encouraging brain health?
Well, I think in this particular case, we have to talk about gentrification. And so gentrification is impacting brain health for our older seniors because they are feeling more isolated if they stay behind in the old neighborhoods. There's no longer those social opportunities, those impromptu opportunities like walking down the street and knowing the store owner or knowing your neighbors or knowing other shoppers, other pedestrians. And then you also have a feeling of isolation if you move out of the area and you're not with your familiar neighbors. And so the reminiscence piece in this SHARP study is really powerful, I would say, for well-being. It gives people a chance to process with compassionate peers what this means to grow older in a neighborhood where you no longer see a reflection of yourself. And reminiscing, I think that that's a beautiful way to start a socially engaging relationship with peers because you have a common historical background.
I want to move on to Ms. White about her experience, but one last question. You're in the second stage of this study. I understand the first stage was for people who were basically in fine cognitive health. The second includes people with some mild cognitive impairment. How will you measure the results?
So in the beginning of the study at baseline and then at the end of the study at 6 months, we are doing a screen, which is the Montreal Cognitive Assessment. And so this is a screen. It's not a full-on cognitive assessment. And so from this, we can tell some people who are experiencing some memory loss, which may be mild cognitive impairment, and then those score a certain number or higher. We are calling them cognitively healthy.
Ms. Edna White, I understand that you were born in the Vanport Hospital in 1947. That was the year before the Vanport flood wiped out homes for so many people. You live in Northeast Portland now. Is memory loss something that you had been worried about beforehand?
Yes, because it doesn't necessarily run in my family, but because I'm an older person, I know many people who have different phases of memory loss. And all of us talk about it because when we gather together in our groups, it's like we need the group to remember a whole situation. Mm-hmm. And so we talk about that quite frequently. A lot of the individual, my friend, older friends who have whose parents were still living, that was a concern. So, yes.
How have you seen gentrification affect the neighborhoods that you grew up in between 1947 and now?
I think I was telling someone the other day that in the late 1950s, my parents bought our family home for $8,000. And now that house now, which is still standing, is worth anywhere from $350,000 to $400,000. I'm not quite sure what. But another home that they bought in the 70s for $14,000 is worth about $300,000 now. So not just financially. Things have increased financially, but also the types of people that are living in the area now that can afford or not afford to live there. So those things I see quite a bit.
Are either of those homes still in your family? Or
No, they're not. No, my parents have passed on, and my family members have moved to other states and this kind of thing. So no, they're not in the family.
You are a long-term resident of North and Northeast Portland and Vancouver a bit too. Has gentrification in this area affected your own sense of belonging in the community that you grew up in?
So many people have come in and out. Some of the people that left, a lot of them are coming back to Portland. And so because I've been here for so long, it actually – it's like the old story about the frog in the hot water. Mm-hmm. You know, you gradually heat it up. Yes. Mm-hmm. They notice because they've been away. And then it – one of the things these walks have done is just made me aware of how much I just overlook just for survival. And I heard about, I noticed when people were moving out to other places, and I thought, they're choosing that. But once you really see what's going on, you see financially it's just becoming very hard to afford a home, period.
What do you mean things that you've overlooked just for survival? What kind of things?
Well, I think we get captivated by what they call the tyranny of the immediate. You're so busy living, work, taking care of your health, helping your family, and just other things, just trying to find joy, that you just try to do what you can to survive. And so there's a lot of things that just kind of escape your notice. I was telling somebody that going on these walks have made me realize that I actually missed a decade. There was a decade of where I really was not even connected to the area I lived in. I was busy trying to travel. I was busy trying to make sure I had enough money for my old age. Just trying to enjoy myself, taking care of parents and this sort of thing. And then and I realized that I missed out on some of the things that went on. When we look at these questions these talking points where we talk about the memory joggers. I think about what, you know, I don't have any memories of that. What was I doing?
Raina Croft, I mentioned in the beginning that African-American senior citizens are more likely than whites to develop Alzheimer's and other forms of dementia. What are the thoughts about why that is?
Well, you should really look at the Alzheimer's Association 2017 facts and figures. You will be astounded at some of the facts about Alzheimer's disease. For African Americans, there is a disproportionate rate of chronic conditions such as obesity, hypertension, heart disease. And a lot of this has to do with social determinants of health, less access to quality health information, or sticking with the old ways of believing that, you know, getting old and grandma losing her memory is just part of getting old. And so they're not seeking early care or even seeking preventive care. And so all of these things contribute to our brain health. And if you are not living in an area that is very walkable, you're not going to want to engage in walks. If you are not connected with your community or with your neighbors or have that intergenerational neighbor trust, which was cultivated in the historically black neighborhoods, you won't be as socially engaged and you will slowly begin to be isolated, and all of that will affect your brain health.
And you you work in the neurology department, but you're not a neurologist by training, right? You're
an anthropologist.
When you look at this field, what else do you find when you look at brain health from what might be called an Afrocentric perspective?
You need to be motivated to engage in behaviors, health behaviors, that will be good for your brain as you age, that will improve your overall quality of life. And to be motivated, it's got to be something that really gets at your center of who you are, of the culture you identify with, of who you identify as a person. And I think that this program really hones in on the African-American experience and the value and vibrancy of the African-American communities. And having these recorded is a huge motivator because people know that these recordings will be used for an online health tool about community health and the connection to individual health as we age, and also in-person learning sessions for older African-Americans and families about cognitive health. It's really taking our neighborhood history, preserving it, and doing something active with it for the next generation.
Carry me back to old Virginia. There's where the cotton and the corn and taters grow. There's where the birds warble sweet in the springtime. There's where the old darkest heart am long to go. There's where I labored so hard, poor old Massa, day after day in a field of yellow corn. No place on earth do I love more sincerely than old Virginny, the state where I was born. Carry me back to old Virginny. There's where the cotton and the corn and taters grow. There's where the birds warble sweet in the springtime. There's where this old dark is hard and long to go.
And today we will hear from 65-year-old Francine Anderson. She grew up in a small town in Virginia during the 1950s, and she came to StoryCorps to share a painful childhood memory. And just a warning, this story contains a racial slur.
We were traveling with my father in the car late at night, and there's a road that was long and dark. And my father did what no black man at the time was supposed to do. He allowed his car to run out of gas. He ended up pushing the car, and the only place he could get to was a white truck stop with the white only signs up. And he went up to the door, and he just knocked at it. And the guy came up, and he said, "What are you doing, Negro? Get away from here. Can't you read?" And my dad, he took his hat and held it in his hand, trying to make himself small because he was kind of a tall man. And he said to the guy, "I see your sign, sir. I'm sorry. I'm not trying to disturb you or your business. I just got my young kids in the car, and could I just buy a couple of gallons of gas?" And the guy said, "I don't deal with your kind." And he stepped back and he slammed the door. I saw my dad turn and walk back to the car. And I knew that my dad was afraid. And he got in the car. And I can remember asking him questions. Why can't we go? Why won't he give us any gas? And he wasn't answering. It occurred to me as a little kid, we're in real trouble. And then the door to the place opened, and another man came out. And my dad stiffened up, and this guy got to the passenger window and said, "I don't know what's wrong with that guy. I'm going to go get you some gas, okay?" I remember my dad was real grateful and saying, "Let me give you these few dollars." And the guy was saying, "No, no, it's okay." And I guess I felt ashamed at that moment for my dad, you know, not because he'd done anything wrong, but because I felt like he had been made smaller in my eyes as a child. But now when I talk to people about that story, if I talk to whites about that story, they focus on the man and how kind he was. And he was kind. But at the same time, when I talk to blacks about that story, they're more focused on the fact that it wasn't illegal for him to deny us gas. That was the law of the land. And had my dad been defiant, the absolute risk was that you could be killed for speaking up for yourself. So it's the first time that I realized that there was real danger there. I was 5 years old.
Francine Anderson speaking at StoryCorps in Oakland. Her story will be archived at the Library of Congress.
Black babies cost less.
When Rotunda Freeman's niece, Shy Shy Pate, went missing in a small town in Georgia in 1998, her family began a campaign to find her that continues to this day. It received much less media attention than the cases of Elizabeth Smart and Natalie Holloway. Instead, her family has had to rely for almost two decades on social media and the local news to keep people aware of Shy Shy's disappearance. Rotunda Freeman joins us now to discuss what happened, along with Jessica Testa, a national reporter at BuzzFeed News, who recently wrote about the case. Her piece, The Lost Girl of Unadilla, argues that what happened to Shy Shy is part of a larger narrative about how the stories of missing black girls often go unheard or are overshadowed by the media's focus on missing white girls. It also looks at how law enforcement handles these cases. I'm very pleased to welcome Rotunda Freeman and Jessica Testa to our show now. Hi.
Hi, thank you for having me. This is Rosalinda Freeman.
Jessica, didn't the late Gwen Ifill coin the term missing white woman syndrome in 2004? What did she mean by that?
She did. She was referring to the phenomenon that happens when, you know, you'll see on cable news or something like that, this sort of obsessive 24-hour coverage of a missing, pretty, blonde, white woman. And the lack, in comparison, of the coverage of missing black women who go missing around the same time and under similar conditions.
Is it just race, or is there also class?
Class, absolutely. Absolutely.
The FBI says that nearly 56% of the country reported missing minors in 2016, that 56% of them were girls, and nearly 39% were black. That's an awful lot of kids.
Yes, it is. And there is a great organization called the Black and Missing Foundation that tracks these numbers as well. And I believe by their count in 2014, there were 64,000 black women and girls who were missing, not who went missing in 2014, but who had been collectively missing the state of missing women in 2014.
And doesn't Natalie Wilson of the Black and Missing Foundation say police often attach stereotypes to missing black children?
Yes, they do. Missing black children are often considered to be runaways. There are fewer Amber Alerts issued for missing children of color. And as we know, Amber Alert is instrumental in helping parents find their children in the critical 24 hours after they go missing.
So when black girls go missing, it's often described as a runaway, whereas if a white kid goes missing, she might have been abducted?
Yes, that's the organization's findings.
And what does that mean for how they're covered by the media?
It means that the media is not necessarily going to pick up a runaway story. The media is only really going to, especially local media, is only really going to start paying attention when there is some sort of community outrage. If it's a prominent girl from a wealthy local family in a pristine neighborhood who goes missing, that's a very attractive story for the media.
So we're not going to see Amber Alerts with black kids?
You certainly do see Amber Alerts, but the people from the Black and Missing Foundation, you know, their belief is that you don't see them as often as you do for children of color who go missing.
Rotondo, how big is, am I pronouncing it right, Unadilla, Georgia?
Unadilla.
How big is it?
It's small. It's not really big. It's not a really huge town. It's really small. I can't even tell you how many people is there. But it's a really small little city in Georgia.
And Shai Shai grow up in a tight-knit neighborhood?
Yes. Like everybody knew everybody pretty much.
What's her real name, her full name?
Her name is Shakimia Shires Pate.
She disappeared when she was 8.
Yes.
Did you live nearby?
At the time, I was staying in Michigan, but the rest of my brothers and sisters, they all stayed in Unadilla at the time.
And now we're talking to you from a small town in Ohio.
Yes, I'm traveling. I moved back to Georgia a couple years ago, so now I stay like about 30 miles north of Unadilla. I stay in a town called Ronald Robbins, Georgia.
I'm speaking with Rotondo Freeman, the aunt of Shai Shai Pate, and Jessica Testa, national reporter at BuzzFeed News. She's written an article called The Lost Girl of Unadilla. This is WMIC, WMIC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. When did stories about missing children become popular in America, Jessica?
The panic over missing children really began in the 80s, and that's when we saw kids on the side of the milk carton. That practice diminished by the end of that decade, but certainly the sort of feeling, the fears that emerged from the side of the milk carton. And again, the media scene was also emerging. National media was becoming more of a presence in the 80s. So those two things together really created an awareness of missing children that didn't exist before.
Didn't the conversation about missing black girls get some attention earlier this year when it was reported that 14 black girls went missing in Washington, D.C. in just 24 hours?
Yes, and that's what really inspired the story. Back in March, reports started emerging on social media that 14 black girls had gone missing in one 24-hour period in D.C. And the Metropolitan Police Department in D.C. pretty quickly denied that this was true. They said that this was a misinterpretation of police data on social media, but the story had a life of its own. We saw celebrities tweeting about it. We saw people on Facebook and Instagram sharing images of the missing girls. We saw members of Congress writing to the Department of Justice asking them to investigate this.
And what was the final story? Were the police correct? Was it a matter of inaccurate reporting?
Yeah, it was a misinterpretation. What had happened was the Metropolitan Police Department had started tweeting out their missing persons flyers, and they were not tweeting them live as they were happening. Like, the person didn't go missing and then they automatically tweeted this flyer. They were just sort of tweeting their backlog of flyers.
So this is 14 girls who had gone missing over a fairly long period of time.
Right, right. So those girls, some of them I think had even been found by then. But the story again took off, and I think it did because, as I write in my story, even though the number wasn't true, people believed that it could be true.
And part of the story you write about here, and we'll get into it in more detail later, is how the media reports on its own approach to these kinds of stories.
Right, right. Particularly back in 2002, which is one of the earliest and biggest instances of missing white woman syndrome that I found. And of course, that was 2 years before Gwen Ifill even coined the term. But what happened is, in Milwaukee, a girl went missing named Alexis Patterson. She went missing, I believe it was a short time before Elizabeth Smart went missing. And after Elizabeth Smart went missing, reporters in Milwaukee pointed out that Alexis Patterson had only garnered something like 67, somewhere in the 60s, articles about her disappearance, whereas Elizabeth Smart, in the first few days she went missing, there were hundreds of articles about
400,
her.
400, in fact, in the first 10 days.
Right.
Did other media outlets react once the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel pointed out this discrepancy?
Yes, as soon as that became a story, we saw outlets like CNN, ABC News, CBS News picking up the fact that there was this missing girl in Milwaukee who had not received the same attention as Elizabeth Smart. However, as I noted in the story, I think that people what that did is it didn't put the focus on Alexis Patterson's disappearance and her family. It put the focus on the media.
Why did Laurent Bourgeois, Alexis's stepfather, say that his criminal record stopped people from looking for Alexis?
That's another thing. The Black and Missing Foundation talks about this, about how if there's a person in the family with a criminal record, they're going to be the first suspect, first person suspected by police of being involved in the disappearance.
But they didn't prove that he had done anything.
They didn't, no.
Are there similarities between Alexis's story and Shai Shai's?
You know, the same similarities between their stories and between Elizabeth Smart's. They're all just these kids who went missing at a far too young age. And, well, unlike Elizabeth Smart, Alexis has never been found and Shai Shai's never been found.
Rotunda, wasn't Shai Shai going to a high school football game on the night that she disappeared?
Yes, sir.
So when was she last seen?
Her sister seen her as she was going to go get gas and to pick up a friend. She seen her on one of the little friend's porches, and a young lady up the street from where Shasha came up missing from said she seen Shasha going back towards her home.
And that was the last time anybody saw her?
Yes. Well, that's the last time that we have any reports of anyone seeing her.
Didn't an officer from the Unadilla Police Department tell Shai Shai's mother, Veronica, that Shai Shai had to be gone for 24 hours before she could be considered missing?
Yes.
Is that official policy?
I guess at that time, that's what he felt that it was.
Jessica, do you know if that's official police policy? It has to be 24 hours? I mean, we're talking about an 8-year-old kid here.
Absolutely. The Unadilla Police Department has since been dissolved and taken over by the Dooley County Sheriff's Department. And an investigator from that department told me that he believed that this officer was just a young officer, and that was absolutely not the policy.
Aren't the first hours after someone disappears really critical in finding them?
Yes, that thing you always see on procedural crime TV shows, that, you know, the first hours are critical. That's true for a reason.
And then the Dooley County Sheriff's Department only learned about the case the following morning.
Right.
Rotunda, what was the search like?
I wasn't there doing the search, but from what my brothers and sisters, plus the other people in the community to say, like, everyone that's opened up their home.
They search
people's homes, yards, the woods. They searched everywhere. Say everyone, like, just open up their doors for the police to come in.
And then the fire department did ground and grid searches.
Right.
Yes.
Why would they do that?
Because they was thinking, like, in most cases, when someone first get kidnapped, that they may have got killed or something like that. So they wanted to do, they like, pretty much wanted to do the search from, you know, to cover all their bases instead of just saying, okay, yes, we closed by the freeway, so whoever got her, they just jumped on the freeway and just left. So, I mean, keep from just coming up with saying we're not going to search here, we're just going to search every place that we could think of.
So the Georgia State Patrol's aviation unit also took aerial photos for 10 square miles. Why would we then think that this case was handled inadequately?
I don't think it was. Rotondo, you definitely go ahead.
No, you could go ahead first. That's fine.
I was just saying that once the Dooley County Sheriff's Department got involved, I think they did, you know, everything they possibly could. They were riding through the woods. They were in the air, as you said. But it was really those critical first 14 plus hours.
And how much media coverage did Shy Shy's disappearance receive at that time, Rotondo?
Just local news out of Macon.
Was there a point where you felt that people weren't paying as much attention anymore?
Yes. Until social media came along, we really didn't know what the police, what all they was doing to keep it out there. Only time that we know, like the media come in and have anything to say or want to question about her disappearance is around the anniversary or when the Missing Children Foundation put out a new photo. And that was like within five years or so.
Yeah, and I think social media has become a huge resource for not just this family, but other families.
Media wasn't really even around at the time that Shy Shy disappeared.
Of course not. But today, it does seem to be a way for families to try and keep the story alive.
Didn't police in Florida receive some pushback in June for saying that 12-year-old black twin sisters were runaways? They said that they weren't described as missing because they didn't meet the Department of Justice criteria for an Amber Alert. What are the criteria?
Well, there's a number of criteria that I'm, to be honest, not able to list all of it, but I think the main one was that police need to believe that the girls, in this case, the twin girls, were in immediate danger, and they did not, for whatever reason, believe that.
Do we know what happened to those kids?
Those kids were eventually found a few days later at the home of a family friend. So it does appear that the police were right. These children were not in immediate danger, but they weren't really communicating to the public why they believed that, which led to this enormous public backlash.
Well, why wouldn't the family friend have alerted the family or the police that the kids were with them?
I'm not sure. I think that, you know, every missing children's case is different, including runaway cases. You know, oftentimes there's family strife. You know, there could be a number of reasons.
What's the RILIA alert?
The RILIA alert was created out of frustration surrounding the Amber Alert. It was made so that families could, you know, basically have their own version of the Amber Alert without having to go through the strict Department of Justice criteria.
And this was named in memory of a 4-year-old black girl who vanished while she was in the Florida foster care system?
Yes, she's still never been found.
Aren't the criteria for a RILIA alert broader so that they actually include runaways?
They do. And if you look, they have a Twitter account where they post RILIA alerts as they come in. And unfortunately, though, the thing about this system is that it's not very widely known about, very widely used. It seems like the Twitter account is the main mechanism for getting the word out, but I don't see a lot of families even knowing about it.
Medical apartheid, the dark history of medical experimentation on black Americans from colonial times to the present.
2 weeks ago, state officials gathered in a shopping center parking lot in Dundalk to declare August 1st Henrietta Lacks Day. Last night, the Baltimore City Council adopted its own measure to create a holiday in honor of the woman whose cancer cells led to advances in treatment of cancer, polio, HIV/AIDS, and other diseases. Those cells were taken from Lacks by Johns Hopkins doctors without her knowledge or consent. WYPR's Dominique Maria Benessi reports that lack of consent, compounded by a history of mistrust of medical institutions, still reverberates in Baltimore's gay black community.
Many became familiar with the story of Henrietta Lacks through the HBO movie The Immortal Life of Henrietta Lacks, based on the nonfiction novel by Rebecca Skloot.
Everyone's saying Henrietta Lacks donated themselves. She didn't donate nothing. They took them and didn't ask.
There was also the infamous case of 600 black men at Tuskegee University in Alabama whose syphilis went untreated without their knowledge or consent as part of a U.S. Public Health Service study from 1932 to 1972. Their story was dramatized in the 1997 movie Miss Evers' Boys.
The fact remains that patients with a potentially fatal disease went untreated when treatment was available.
It was for the greater good.
Who's good, Miss Evers?
The relationship between medical institutions and the black community has come a long way since then. There are now laws requiring patients to sign consent forms so patients know what they're getting into. But those stories still resonate, especially in Baltimore's gay black community.
I used to live close to Hopkins when I was in grad school. And I remember at night when I was coming from college, the driver would be like, "Don't go out at night because they can pick you up for research." Yeah.
That's Kahinde Batamosi, the Social Innovations Marketing Manager at the Bureau of HIV Services for the Baltimore City Health Department. Batamosi says that even in 2014, a lot of his neighbors around Johns Hopkins believed the driver's warning.
I'm sure he didn't mean it that way. He just wanted me to have some kind of hatred toward the institution.
When Batamosi learned more about Henrietta Lacks, he understood.
Oh, I see where this was coming from.
Those negative narratives and misconceptions of medical institutions, says Yvonne Kenyon, a care provider with the Baltimore Health Department, are barriers that make it difficult to get young gay men into HIV treatment.
I found that there were plenty of young people that I worked with who were, for many, many complicated reasons, unable or unwilling to adhere to a medication regimen that I would recommend.
Kingon, who worked for 13 years in New York City as a nurse practitioner, says many young people with HIV fail to keep follow-up appointments because they feel judged or stigmatized by their disease, society, or care providers.
Which is often heard as, "What's wrong with you? Why can't you do this? What don't you understand? Do you want to die?" Very, very judgmental kinds of questions that may not be said out loud, but that's how they're received.
In an effort to make more young black gays feel more comfortable talking about the challenges they face with their disease and seeking care, Batamosi and the health department have started a YouTube series called Baltimore in Conversation.
I got frustrated and I got angry because I just thought it was such a generic model. I thought it didn't meet me at my needs.
In this video, 26-year-old Stefan Hernandez speaks to a support group for young gay black men. He's talking about one of the support groups he was in prior to coming to Baltimore. Hernandez says when he was told he had HIV, he didn't like the type of one-size-fits-all treatment he received prior to coming to the city.
And I was lucky. I had friends who supported me, but there are so many people out there who do not have those support systems because they can't even get through the phrase of saying, "I have HIV."
Hernandez is not alone in feeling stigmatized. Corey Bradley volunteers with Kahinde Batamosi at the health department. He is a doctoral candidate at Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health. Bradley, also a gay black man, wonders about other factors that make his peers feel vulnerable.
When testing vans, and tell me if I'm wrong, because this is what I understand from the community and from talks that I've heard, when the testing van is out and you go up to say, you know, "I need to be tested," or whatever the case is, "I want to be tested," they can actually pull your name up and they can see whether or not you are actually positive or not, how long you've been in care, or if you're currently in care. Is that true?
Batamosi nods his head yes. Bradley replies he'd like to see some system that notifies patients when someone looks up their medical information. Kind of like,
when you submit for credit report, it will let you know so-and-so has looked up your credit and that has affected your credit in one way or another.
Batamosi and Bradley say they recognize the importance of scientific research and testing for HIV and other sexually transmitted diseases to report to the Center for Disease Control and Prevention. but constant requests for blood samples from Baltimore's gay black community to do that research reminds people of the past.
And it begins to make people feel, why are we overstudied? Why are you always coming to us?
Bradley chimes in and adds,
you know, as
and
much
we're
as
not getting better. In some people's eyes, you keep collecting this data. I do research. You keep collecting this data, and the rates for HIV are going up.
In 2014, 76% of people living with HIV in Baltimore were black. According to AIDSVU, a National Institute of Health-funded website to prevent the spread of HIV and other sexually transmitted diseases. And black men in Baltimore are 11.1 times more likely to be diagnosed with HIV than white men. Bradley says he and his Hopkins colleagues struggle with the delicate task of making data and information about HIV relevant, accessible, and meaningful to people they serve, given the hospital's lingering reputation.
So that people don't feel like we just keep coming and running HIV tests, collecting blood, and writing papers and getting rich. We also need to be clear that Hopkins has the reputation that it has. Now, this is tough to deal with. Hopkins is who it is because of the suffering of people in Baltimore.
Kingon says the health department's care providers have changed the way they interact with their patients in hopes of changing the negative narratives. She says rather than looking at just the disease, they look at the whole patient and try to create rapport.
We would say things like, why don't you just come in? I promise I won't talk about meds. Come in every 3 months. We'll do some labs if you're okay with that. Let me just know how you're doing.
Meanwhile, Batamosi is taking a different approach to ease suspicions and help young men with HIV stay in continuous care.
So we need to find these stories. We need stories. Stories that are going to help us to understand, you know, all of these very mysterious things about healthcare. Let's humanize healthcare.
Batamosi says he hopes through storytelling he can change the narrative and mend the wounds of the past. I'm Dominique Maria Benessi for 88.1 WYPR.
Seattle's a great place to visit because it has, I guess you could say, a little bit of everything, but I like to think of it as a lot of everything.
And today I'm with Ron Sims, former King County executive, former deputy secretary at HUD in the Obama administration. Welcome back, Ron. We'll get your microphone on. Sydney Brownstone, reporter at The Stranger. Hi there.
Hey.
Rob McKenna, former Washington State Attorney General. Good to see you again.
Thank you, Bill.
So on the Week in Review today, our first conversation is going to be about how to respond to the Trump administration and to white nationalists. Last weekend in Seattle, a right-wing group called Patriot Prayer rallied at Westlake Center. The organizer, Joey Gibson, told his followers before the rally not to engage in any physical fighting. On stage, he denounced the Ku Klux Klan and the white supremacist violence in Charlottesville. He invited counter-protesters to address the crowd, and he said he was not in Seattle to instigate violence.
I mean, I am an instigator because I go into these liberal areas and I say my name is Joey Gibson, and I love America, and I love everything about it. I love freedom, and I'm polite, and I'm respectful. I do not ever cuss at them, and I'm not ever hateful towards them. If we can't be free to talk and to have a conversation and to have a debate, that's an attack on free speech. And the only way we can do that is to begin to love people. We don't have to like someone. There's a lot of people who annoy the crap out of me who I love to death, okay? But we can focus on love and focus on being good people and appreciate other people's opinions and stop getting triggered so much. And I believe that is the key. That is the purpose of political correctness, so that we don't talk, so that we don't exchange our different ideas. Because when we talk and we talk about differences of opinion, both people, if they're open, they both grow. They don't necessarily agree with each other, but they grow.
Counter-protesters held their own event in Denny Park, calling it Solidarity Against Hate. This woman identified herself as Blossom. She said the violence in Virginia inspired her to show up.
I don't want Nazis to gain a foothold in the U.S. I think that if we don't fight against them, then they're going to think that it's okay for them to be Nazis. And that's not what I want for this country. That's not what I want for the world.
Not everyone was as calm as Blossom and Gibson. There were racist slogans and air horns and screaming and scuffling. Seattle police largely kept the two groups apart, sometimes with pepper spray. Is the counter-protesting helpful? Did I just make a false equivalence? On Saturday Night Live, Tina Fey said white nationalists should just be ignored.
I would urge people this Saturday, instead of participating in the screaming matches and potential violence, find a local business you support, maybe a Jewish-run bakery or an African-American-run bakery. Order a cake with the American flag on it, like this one, and just eat it, Colin.
She tore into that sheet cake while mocking Trump and Ann Coulter and Paul Ryan and neo-Nazis, and this was her conclusion.
I really want to say, to encourage all good, sane Americans to treat these rallies this weekend like the opening of a thoughtful movie with two female leads. Don't show up. Let these morons scream into the empty air. I love you, Charlottesville, and as Thomas Jefferson once said, who's that hot light-skinned girl over by the butter churn?
Tina Fey, everyone!
Confront, ridicule, ignore Ron Sims. When the next right-wing rally hits Seattle, and it will, what will you do?
I'll ignore them. You know, it's really interesting. I don't mind silent protest. Because that's very powerful, too, for people just to go. You're not going to drown them out. There's no reason to get in an argument. But sometimes if you don't see anybody protesting, the assumption is that the community is acquiescing and agreeing with what's being said. So I don't mind having a lot of people hold signs. And I was called, nothing is more powerful at times than a silent protest where you're just holding up the signs, letting the person know that they're not welcome. I believe in free speech. It absolutely is essential. And silent protests with hundreds or thousands of people around the person who is saying things you disagree with proves to be a very, very powerful statement.
Sydney, you agree? The silent statement?
I think there should always be some sort of confrontation. And it's disturbing to me to hear so many people celebrating Tina Fey's statement, because as someone who is a non-Jew and who is white without any skin in the game. I would tell Tina Fey and people who are endorsing that idea is that we've seen before what happens when we ignore white nationalism and what happens when we ignore an open display of racism in our streets. What's that Edmund Burke quote? All that's necessary for the triumph of evil is for good men to do nothing. So, I think there should always be some form of protest from people. And one of the most effective displays of protest I've ever seen, there's been this video floating around the internet about this German town that when they had a neo-Nazi rally, they decided to raise money for an anti-extremist organization by for every number of steps the neo-Nazis walked, they contributed $1. And I just thought that was a perfect way to ridicule them and confront them at the same time. They even had banners up on the streets saying, like, way to go, keep going, you know, keep marching, you're raising more money. So I thought that was incredibly effective. But I don't think we should celebrate doing nothing.
No, I agree. When I was a kid, this is a long time ago, we had a major retailer that only employed African-Americans in the warehouse, never retail, on the basis that his white customers did not want to take change from the hands of a black person. So my parents led a series of demonstrations, and one of them I got spit on by this man. And I chased him. I was really going to whack him with the sign. And my father grabbed me and said, never lower yourself again in front of me. I'll never forget that. That it took courage and discipline not to hit the person who demeaned you. And I never forgot that, saying that the most powerful statement is not to let them win. This person was trying to provoke me. Don't let them win, which I would say being present, holding those signs, literally you're ignoring them in many respects, but you got to make a powerful statement that we're different than they are.
The battles of history. The events surrounding Charlottesville, Virginia, have a resonance far beyond the borders of Old Dominion. Even though they began as a strictly local affair, they quickly assumed a national character because this strictly local event stems from the nation's history, a history that remains not only contested, but bitterly unresolved. That history, of course, is the toxic poison of white supremacy, and the trigger thereof, African slavery, the intentional, centuries-long economic, social, communal, and psychic exploitation of Africans for the financial and psychological benefits of the white nation. This toxin has tainted the bloodstream of the nation and infected all segments of society and was integral to the very development of whiteness as a core identity for millions of people who call themselves Americans. As we look at protests rolling throughout the country, The first thing we must recognize is that this isn't about monuments, nor is it about the Civil War. It is about the present. It is about how this country will define itself, how it sees itself, and how it understands its future. But history, true history, is more about today than yesterday, for it is the pathway to tomorrow, and it lives or dies in the minds of the young who learn or unlearn how this country came to be and what role they play in the days to come. That great black freedom fighter, Malcolm X, repeatedly said, "Of all our studies, history best rewards our research." He knew this not only because he was taught this by his teacher, the Honorable Elijah Muhammad, but because he learned this in the very experience of his life. For as a state prisoner, a man so hated that he was called Satan, his learning of a deeper history of black people literally made him a new man. It gave him confidence. It turned his loathing into loving. It gave him purpose, and perhaps more importantly, perspective. Perspective. How to look at the world, how to interpret it, how to understand why things are the way they are. That's the real value of history. It teaches perspective of the now, not then. And that's the reason why monuments turned green by oxidation and pigeon poop are seemingly at the center of these controversies. The Trump presidency signaled a great leap backwards. It has the expression of a deep, profound fear of the future, of change, of transformation. So they hold on to yesterday, invoking tradition as if the central tradition of America wasn't and isn't black slavery, black exploitation, which launched it into an international economic power. Charlottesville is thus a turning point, a pivot point, upon which the nation turns back or moves forward, creating a new history. This only the people of America can and will decide. From Imprison Nation, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
My reflections on Charlottesville 1 week after. Somehow I didn't think this latest manifestation of hate would come by torchlight. Torches carried by young men who otherwise live by the blue light of cell phones, no doubt early adopters of the latest technological tools. Yet here were these 2017 torchbearers raising the same old-fashioned instruments of hatred, which just a few decades ago lighted untold numbers of lynchings and cross-burnings. These modern marchers came unhooded, angry faces clearly framed by the flickering light, proud to be acknowledged as the vanguard of the neo-Nazis, Ku Klux Klan members, and white nationalists. Peter Sajedinovic doubled down after he was identified from his photo, standing front and center. He told the Reno Gazette-Journal he would defend tooth and nail my views as a white nationalist. Charlottesville, Virginia wasn't your grandfather's race riot. And yet it was. The same rage and resentment from the organizers and their followers, the same venomous targeting of non-whites, particularly African Americans, the same anti-Semitic slurs. Tragically, it has also meant the same deaths of innocents, like Heather Heyer, mowed down while standing up against historic terror writ new. And yet I know Charlottesville is nothing new, and that what it represents has long been just beneath the surface. What happened in Charlottesville was bolstered by a refreshed, re-energized white supremacy, a white supremacy which has been emboldened by a racially divisive time and by a commander-in-chief whose responses, belated and otherwise, are an overt embrace. Most scary to me to see the old racist rant spewed from the mouths of mostly young men. Again, history serves. Are they the re-envisioning of the brown shirts, these newest stormtroopers who found common ground and each other via the internet? They represent relatively small numbers of self-identified white nationalists, but it is alarming to note the nationwide college campus tours where they have gathered new converts to their cause. I don't want the future these young men hope to create. But I do want to see a young Heather Heyer remembered for more than a moment. I do want to see others inspired by her commitment to anti-racism, expressed in her final Facebook post. If you are not outraged, she wrote, you are not paying attention. At least in these still raw moments, a nation is paying attention to the carved symbols of a hateful heritage, to the words of the president who faults both sides for the deliberate attack which ended Heather's life, and to political leaders who have said nothing. In an emotional eulogy, Susan Breaux, Heather's mother, urged mourners to unite. I want this to spread, she said. This is just the beginning of Heather's legacy. But in this ongoing struggle for the American conscience, there is work to be done, and Boston may be uniquely positioned to lead. Who better than a city trying to work through its own racist demons, rejecting a so-called freedom of speech rally and preparing to repair the shattered Holocaust memorial again? Mr. President, there are not two sides, only the right side of history. Heather Heyer knew there was too much at stake to stay on the sidelines. We can only protect the America we say we believe in by doing as much. I'm Callie Crossley, WGBH, Boston's local NPR. In Virginia, them guns go bang, bang. In Virginia, them guns go
bang, bang. In Virginia, them guns go bang, bang. Friday night, August 11th at the University of Virginia. Dozens of white supremacists march onto the campus founded by Thomas Jefferson, wielding torches. You will not
replace us! The very next morning in Charlottesville, not far from UVA, even more white supremacists. They're gathered for a rally called Unite the Right. The stated aim of the march? Stop a statue of Confederate General Robert E. Lee from being taken down by the city. Fights break out with protesters demonstrating against them.
That same afternoon, a car plows into a crowd of those people demonstrating against the white supremacists there.
Cars just ran down all of these people.
19 people are injured. One woman is killed. A man with reported white nationalist ties is arrested and charged with driving the car in that attack.
That evening, the president weighs in.
We condemn in the strongest possible terms this egregious display of hatred, bigotry, and violence on many sides. On many sides.
Monday, after widespread criticism that he didn't go far enough in his condemnation of white nationalists at the rallies, Trump more explicitly rebukes the KKK and neo-Nazis, calling them repugnant and saying, quote, racism is evil.
But the next day, Tuesday, Trump doubles back.
I think there's blame on both sides, and I have no doubt about it.
This is Code Switch. I'm Gene Demby.
And I'm Shireen Marisol Meraji. And on this episode, we're talking about what happened in Charlottesville. You know the basics, but we're going to dig deeper. We'll give you some history with a scholar who's written a book about the politics of white resentment. And we'll talk to a Republican strategist who says the president's response hurt his party.
But first, we're here with our Code Switch teammate, Adrian Florido. Adrian just got back from Charlottesville. He headed down there to see how the people there were trying to reckon with what just happened.
Hey, too.
Hey, Adrian. Now, one of the things you noticed was that a lot of the counter-protesters, a lot of the people who came out to oppose these white nationalists in Charlottesville, they were white.
Yeah, a large majority, in fact, which probably isn't too surprising because Charlottesville is a mostly white town. Mm-hmm. But it is kind of one of the interesting things that's come out of this weekend, right? You've got all these white people now wrestling with the reality that all these people came to their town to spew hate under this banner of whiteness. So if you're white and you don't agree with that, well, what responsibility do you feel?
All right, man. Take us to Charlottesville.
So the morning after the attack, I went to City Hall. Jason Kessler, the white nationalist who'd organized that so-called Unite the Right rally, had planned a press conference out front. And there was this huge semicircle of journalists facing the lectern. But when Kessler came out, he was met by this avalanche of boos and chants of, shame on you, shame on you, shame on you. This was coming from all of the people who had packed in behind the journalists. And for a good 5 minutes, Kessler was trying to speak, but he was just being drowned out.
It really is a sad day in our constitutional democracy when we are not able to have civil liberties like the First Amendment.
And so at one point, this man pushed his way through the journalists and confronted Kessler, and he took a swing at him, and that just sort of worked everyone up. Suddenly you had these camera guys getting closer and these protesters pushing their way through, and they were all furious. And, you know, they were mostly white people, and they basically chased Kessler off from his own press conference until he had to take safety behind a line of police officers. So after this scene sort of settled down, I spoke to one of the protesters, Kate Fraley.
Yeah, so I think that the people of color in town need white folks to stand up to the powers that be, because we don't get arrested, and they do. So I think we owe it to the people of color in this community to be on the forefront of this argument, because it's white supremacy that's making the problem, and we are white, and we need to fix it.
This is an idea I heard over and over from white folks I spoke with in the last couple of days, this disgust that such an explicit form of racist white supremacy had reared its head here in progressive Charlottesville.
It's a good town. What happened yesterday is just, it's unreal. I can't believe it happened.
This is out of something from a different century.
I wish I could be black just to feel for one day what it feels like to be in Charlottesville for one day.
Wow! Hey, yo, drama, hold up, sir. Hold on. Stop the motherfucking record. All right. I want you to Pondy replay, drama. Pondy replay. Just give him one more chance, man. Run that shit the fuck back.
I wish I could be black just to feel for one day what it feels like to be in Charlottesville for one day.
That was Keith Patterson, Mary Goodrich, and Nina Knight. These folks, like so many I spoke with, felt a sense of responsibility to do something. Caroline Lako went to the Kessler press conference and was holding a sign.
What does your sign say?
It says, Nazis, go home.
Her husband's sign said, just leave.
When you turn on the news and you see all these stories from around the world saying this horrible violence in Charlottesville, all these racists attacking people, this is not what Charlottesville is. Charlottesville is about inclusiveness and trying to help each other.
This feeling that it is an inclusive place is so strongly held in this liberal college town that the attack over the weekend felt like a harsh reality check.
I think people are ashamed.
Laura Goldblatt is a community organizer and a researcher at the University of Virginia.
Charlottesville has a lot of farmers, has a lot of farming communities, and people who come from a long blue-collar history. And I think the fact that someone was killed when she was trying to put a stop to hate and racism makes them feel ashamed about the ways that that history is celebrated.
Though Charlottesville today is a largely liberal town, it's also a kind of sprawling monument to Thomas Jefferson, who founded the University of Virginia, and whose slave plantation, Monticello, sits on a hill overlooking the city. In 1921, hood-wearing Klan members inaugurated their local chapter with a midnight ceremony at Jefferson's tomb. Over the next several years, the city erected several Confederate monuments, including the one to Robert E. Lee that the white nationalists were trying to defend last weekend.
And at the time that they were put up, members of the Klan rallied around them during their dedication. There was a lot of celebration and fanfare. And so the statues and Thomas Jefferson are all kind of part of this ecosystem of the long history of white supremacy in this area, and the statues are a symbolic representation of that.
So Goldblatt says it's no surprise that as Charlottesville has taken steps to take these statues down, the Klan and other white nationalists would come here to try to reclaim a past they feel is slipping away. On Sunday, dozens of people gathered at the downtown intersection where police say James Alex Fields rammed his car into the crowd. The mourners were remembering Heather Heyer, who was killed. Among them was Carol Carruthers Sims, the pastor of a nearby Episcopal church.
And it's an all-white church, and the subject of race has just begun to come up there in discussions.
Sims has lived in Charlottesville for most of her 79 years. And she says for all the talk about being inclusive, the reality in Charlottesville is more complicated.
I think a lot of people, myself included, you're not in contact with the African Americans or the other groups. You're sort of off in your own white, you know, barricade, so to speak. So I think a lot of people just aren't aware, and they go on with their life.
But she says there is tension beneath the surface.
There's a lot of racism in people's minds, and I think, you know, we can be pleasant. Hello, how are you? But I think underneath here in Charlottesville, there's still some prejudice there.
Also at this vigil was a man named Derek. He asked me to use only his first name. Derek is black, a Charlottesville resident. As he looked at the crowd, he said he had mixed feelings.
It's kind of hard to explain. A lot of the people that you see here, they're here for the right reasons, but a lot of them don't really understand the perspective of, let's say, a person of color, how they view the police department, how they view things like access to housing, basically being pulled over for no good reason.
So while he said it was great to see so many people coming out to denounce white nationalists,
this is easy because it's something that everyone's for. But once this goes away, how we deal with all the race issues is going to be what really matters in the long run.
Laura Goldblatt, the organizer and UVA researcher, agrees with him. She brings up a lot of the same issues that Derek did. Advocates have been pushing the city to improve affordable housing and to address concerns over police stops. Last year, a local paper found that nearly 80% of people pulled over by Charlottesville police were black. Only 20% of the town's population is black. The city is also still dealing with the fallout of its decision in the 50s to close white schools for months rather than integrate them. The next decade, it tore down black homes and businesses. Here's Goldblatt.
It's in some ways feels almost so obvious that you should resist something like what we saw on Saturday. But now we need to move into some of the nuts and bolts and the things that make us say, this was so ugly, but we actually have a lot of really ugly policies here.
Goldblatt said those policies are what she hopes Charlottesville residents unite behind next.
That was our teammate Adrian Florido.
Context of white supremacy. Gus T. Renegade in for another broadcast, hopefully to share constructive information on the system of white supremacy. Today's date, Saturday, August 19th, 2017. So I have been told. This is our weekly compensatory call-in. Dial in if you have commentary, thoughts, observations you would like to share. The number to dial, 641-715-3640. The code, 564-943-pound. Press star 6 if you would like to participate. That number again, 641-715-3640. The code, 564-943-pound. Press star 6 if you would like to participate. Couple things before we get started. Thanks to all the folks who have sent well wishes. I've had back problems for about 2 weeks since everything happened with moving furniture. Dumbest idea in the world. It has been extremely painful for about the last 10 days. It's just been difficult for me to sit up. That's why I have not been able to post programs or even to broadcast very much, because it's just not been possible for me to sit up in a chair at a computer without experiencing a significant amount of pain. So thanks for the concern. Well wishes. I am slowly mending. I feel better today than I have in the last 10 days, past 2 days. I have felt a little bit better, but still not pain-free, and ways to go. But thanks for the concern. Hopefully we will continue the improvement and be right as rain shortly. In the meantime, folks would like to invest, feel free. Listener-supported Counter-Racist Radio, the blog racism-notes.blogspot.com. racism-notes.blogspot.com. listener-supported counter-racist radio. When you hit the blog, PayPal button is in the top right corner. If you're not into PayPal, drop me an email. We will get you a physical mailing address. Again, ask everyone to confirm if you're going to mail anything that you have the correct mailing address. I've moved a couple times this year just to make sure that you are correct in where you are posting. Huge thanks to all the folks who have invested, supported in the cows, wish list as well, folks who've nabbed items from the list at Amazon.com under Gusty Renegade. Much obliged for that as well. Appreciate all the support and hope that the context of white supremacy has provided constructive information on what racism, white supremacy is, how it works. That's it. A couple things I wanted to touch on before we get to the callers. A drunken tongue speaks a sober mind. Man, I'm going to use that from this point forward. I never heard that one before, but that is a good one, particularly in the context where they were talking about all this harassment from some racist patron at a nightclub. Next, you heard the segment towards the end there, the NPR segment with Gene Demby. They had Carol Anderson on that program. She wrote the book White Rage. She's a black female. Great information. People have suggested it might be constructive to have her on the program. She had some great insight in that piece as well, just talking about how she thought all of this was a deliberate effort of racism, white supremacy, so that racists could make sure that they have a sizable population of melanated laborers so that whites can continue to enjoy a nice, cushy lifestyle. She said that in the segment, just couldn't play everything that was included. Next up, Pam was supposed to be back on the program this past Wednesday, had to reschedule because of my back issues. We were supposed to have, say, Professor Nancy McLean. She wrote the book Democracy in Chains. We were supposed to have her. Always look forward to having suspected race soldiers on the program. She was supposed to be here this past Monday, had to reschedule because of my back pain. Was looking forward to having a busy August, and all of that got sidetracked. And in fact, given the news that happened this week, I guess I'll explain as we go. But yeah, it's been one of the more difficult months for Gus T to broadcast. The context of white supremacy and the saga continues. Well, I guess I had it to get to right now. Counter racism in terms of sharing information, talking to other non-white people, not something that I do a lot of directly anymore, like trying to go out and get people in person, face-to-face, to address racism, white supremacy. I did go to the book event last month and what have you, a few things, but not as much as I used to because it's been so difficult. But many years ago, before the cows even existed, there was a non-white male. He and I talked about racism, white supremacy. Yellow Manny, he's been on the program repeatedly, talked about racism, white supremacy, non-black, non-white male. His brother, also non-white, non-black male. Yellow Manny and I, we were talking about a race soldier in the Seattle area. We had both concluded that this guy was racist for a variety of reasons. Yellow Manny's brother overheard this conversation. Now, again, this is years ago, about a decade ago. He overhears us. I had just met his brother, so I didn't know him. You know, I met him maybe one time in life. We talked for maybe 5 minutes. And so he's listening to us talk about this suspected race soldier, and he's just like, you know, Gus, I don't know you very well, but, you know, you all sound like you're full of, you know, you can fill in the expletive. And this is in front of other people, so we're just kind of like, wow, he just kind of dissed us in person and doesn't think this white guy is racist. About 8 months later, Yellow Manny's brother also concludes that this white guy is racist. And about 4 years from this point, we recount this episode and he concedes, yeah, I was wrong. you all were right, which is why I recommend being patient with other victims of racism. But if you continue to follow this wacky happenstance meeting that is all centered around, I met his brother talking about racism, white supremacy, shared the information with him. He's called the program. He owns Mr. Fuller's writings, his updated code book. He's spoken with Mr. Fuller, really has appreciated the information and has applied it to his existence as a victim of white supremacy. But now, almost a decade after all of that, now this individual manages a dental facility. And he says, hey, that's I'm applying counter-racism in my dentistry. And in fact, you, Gusty, have not been to the dentist in enough time that you should come in and get your teeth cleaned. And I wrinkled and made all kinds of excuses. And oh, my gosh, I can't go to the dentist. Marcus Garvey told us about the white man's fluoride and every excuse in the book I came up with. And oh, metaphor. It is Saturday. Every possible excuse that I could think of to not go to the dentist. And he eliminated every one of them just casually. You can't even say expenses because he manages the dental facility. I can take 80% off of your bill. So you have absolutely no excuse. So I went in to get a deep cleaning of my teeth this week. It was great. My mouth feels great. I could go out and smile and show off my great dental work, but I don't really have a whole lot to smile about. Still victim of white supremacy. And my back has been in so much trouble. It was a rough day going to the dentist. She lowered me back in the chair. And in fact, at his dental practice, he has hired all non-white staff. Anyway, so as the non-white dentist is lowering me back in the chair, and I was wincing a little bit already, she says, oh, man, what is the problem? I haven't even touched your teeth yet. I said, yeah, but the chair is really putting a lot of pressure on my back. Tough to have to go to the dentist when you are already experiencing back pain. Anyway, why I said this month has been super challenging for Gus T and the saga continues. I am close to having a clean bill of dental health, but I do need to get my wisdom teeth removed, which they're going to do two at a time. So one will be this Tuesday and one the following Tuesday. So it might continue to be difficult for Gus to broadcast. I don't know. I don't know how B feel about talking following the extraction of my wisdom teeth. So we shall have to see. After I heard that, you know, that was what was going to take place, I even contemplated hanging up broadcasting for the rest of the month and just saying this is ridiculous. But we'll see how it goes. I've seen other people get their wisdom teeth extracted and didn't seem to impair them too much. Eating obviously was a little bit more challenging, but they seemed to be able to talk at least a day after, or so day or two after, they seemed at least okay to talk a little bit. So we will update with that. Oh, one more thing to make sure that I get in on all of this with Trump. Man, it sucked. I can speak for myself. I've been in pretty constant pain for about the past 8-9 days or so, in terms of all throughout the day, all throughout the night. It doesn't really matter which position I'm in. I'm still in pain because of my back, whether I'm standing, sitting, prone on the ground. So it's just been very difficult. But I'm not accustomed to having back pain or being in chronic pain at all. So it's been very difficult for me. But it's difficult to concentrate if you are in constant pain. So I've not really been able to follow all of the news over the past week. So for all of the things that went down in Charlottesville, I said for years, my alma mater, the University of Virginia, to be born in Virginia and have all of this going down, my former stomping ground, and to not be able to pay attention. And oh, the people, man, what a time to be injured. It was a tough week to see so much commentary going down about my beloved alma mater. But I'm sure there will be other opportunities to continue the dialogue. And I'm sure you all were able to catch up and be abreast of what has taken place. But I was going to say, given everything that has happened, I would totally double down on Trump 2020. Absolutely. If you can get to Vegas, you can put in $50 for Gus T. Trump 2020. I don't care who he's running against. If they want to put Obama on the ticket again, his children, Michelle Obama, they want to resurrect Nelson Mandela, make him a U.S. citizen. Anybody, MLK, anybody else you want to put on the ticket, Trump 2020, already taking them. With that, if you have commentary, if we could refrain from using metaphors for this broadcast exclusively, I've seen where racists, they will use metaphors consistently to be deceptive. They will compare things that are not equivalent. They do this on a regular basis. Victims, this behavior has been modeled for us. And then a lot of us, Gusty included, we are still learning. We have not come to conclusions on some aspects of racism, white supremacy. Sometimes we will use a metaphor, hoping that it conveys our thoughts. And what it does is spread confusion. If we could just make an effort to be direct, explicit about what it is we want to say. And if you can't do that, if you find that you have to use some sort of metaphor to articulate what you want to say, maybe that means that you should take time, think a bit more about whatever concept it is that you're trying to express to make sure that you have all the data that you need to confidently explain this to someone else in a logical manner. If we could take 5 minutes to share whatever thoughts that we have, that would be great. Just make sure everyone gets an opportunity to share. I will prompt about the time as well. If you know you're in a noisy environment, if you could use your mute button, that would be super appreciated. Just unmute yourself. You can say whatever you want. And then once you're done, if you can use your mute button, that will just make sure that everyone gets the same courtesy in speaking and preserves the quality of the audio broadcast. Much obliged. With that, we will get to the first few folks who dialed in with a hand up. Line should be open. Proceed.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Greetings, everyone. Black male calling from Texas. I'm actually driving home. I just came from Dallas's anti-white supremacist rally. And the reason I decided to go specifically was to see if they were going to be truthful and to see how many confused individuals were present. It's a lot of confusion. Suspected white supremacists made a lot of signs that were clever. There's a lot of laughing going on. So that let me know that this is not a serious affair for people who attended, who say they want to fight white supremacy and Nazism, which the irony being, for anyone who is a student of history, knows that the beginning thoughts of where the Third Reich got their ideas, they stole them from the United States of America. So Nazism is very much an American phenomenon. The eugenics program started in the United States. They rounded up the Jews based upon laws that segregated blacks in this country. So it's just a lot of confusion saying one of the signs that I saw that Nazism is un-American, it's very American. I even saw some dogs that signed that said that we'll bite racist, and I wondered why that dog wasn't going crazy and biting everybody in sight. So it was not a serious affair. And I did see some signs that said give up white supremacy, and I was a white person with a sign. I just wondered if they, to what extent that they knew what that meant. If white supremacy disappeared right now, what that would mean in terms of everything that has been influenced by racism, they would be devastated. I say that recently reading an article by Kwame Holmes talking about necrocapitalism, and it was a well-written article. I will see if I can email that to you guys if you're interested. But it talks about how there is a city in Minnesota whose property value has increased 13% over the past year, and that has beat the market. If anyone is informed about how market economics goes, there's no such thing as beating the market. You can be well versed in finance and guess every once in a while to make a small profit, but over the long run, you cannot beat what the average rate is for value. Well, the only significant incident that happened in this city called Falcon Heights was that Philando Castile was murdered. So Kwame Holmes ties the idea of anti-blackness and getting rid of black individuals as a mechanism to increase value and property. So when white people are saying they want to end white supremacy, I highly doubt that if they are willing to come up off the equity value in their homes currently to include the previous generations, and then you'll have some suspected racist or racist tell you that, oh, well, you know, that's how the free market works. Well, per their logic, they were looking for a robbery suspect, which it was not Philando Castile, which tells me that if Philando wasn't the robber, that means your robber is still not caught, which means that per your logic, your property value should not be increasing. They should at least be steady and then going down, which lets me further believe that it doesn't matter who you catch. One less black person will do. So, you know, it was really interesting going to the anti-white supremacist rally and hear people talk about bringing down the Confederate statues and all of these things that are symbolic of ending racism. But in practice, in terms of essentially restructuring this entire country from all institutions and all laws, I don't believe that the people who say they are invested in that enterprise are willing. And that is all I will have to share right now. Thank you.
May I be heard?
Yes, ma'am. I just wanted to say briefly, it can be a great idea, those type of events, if it's a rally or a meeting, if you have a question or a counter-racist experiment, that can be a great environment for counter-racist exercises. Proceed, ma'am.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call. Glad to hear that you are doing at least better. This is Red from Ohio. Had some commentary first about my ongoing commentary about the opioid epidemic here in Ohio. In the most recent Columbus Dispatch Sunday paper, so that was August 13th, they were talking about how the title of the article says Democrats urge state to declare emergency. So basically, it's the Democrats, they're trying to urge the governor, Governor Kasich, to declare the opioid epidemic an emergency so that way they can get more money. Now, also in the article, just going to point out a few things in the article. There was an official, he is in Kasich's administrative, a part of his administration. He said that the state is already spending $1 billion, and this is of federal money. So that caught my attention because now it's not just, you know, they're taking money from, you know, non-whites in Ohio. This is from every non-white person just to make sure that they can try to save the whites here. And I'm sure if they're doing this in other states. They also, once again, in this article, there were some health officials in different county it basically said there's a health official, it's a county behavioral health authorities, also giving out, also explaining different ideas about how to combat this quote-unquote epidemic. And, of course, she mentioned to improve the availability of naloxone, sorry, which is also Narcan. They also cited that in 2016, more than 4,100 people died from drug overdoses, which is a 36% increase from 2015. And they're also wanting to use the, apparently Ohio has a $2 billion rainy day fund, and this is what is quoted in the article, and they want to try to use that to help save white lives. So I wanted to mention that. Second thing I wanted to point out was the terrorists who were in Charlottesville, so the one who killed the white woman, of course, are from the great state of Ohio. The one who killed the woman, and then also the one, there's a group of men, white men, who were beating this black male, named DeAndre, who were beating him almost to death. One of them was also from Ohio, so
thought that was, you know, they will come from anywhere up north to support white supremacy, of course. Also wanted to, ask the question, and this is, I guess, rhetorical. I'm wondering if now Susan Breaux, which is Heather Hare's, I'm pronouncing her last name wrong, her mother, I wonder if she's also going to be now a part of the Mothers of the Movement group. I appreciated the information about the Aurelia Alert, and also definitely thought the Tina Fey commentary about the joke about Thomas Jefferson, of course, trashy. And I guess I will just, I'll just end my commentary there. Thank you.
Appreciate that, Red. If we have other folks who have a hand up, if you have commentary you would like to share, line should be open. Proceed.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Yes, this is Ken Steele, and I'm currently in Chino, California. I just wanted to start off my this week's report by saying rest in power to master teacher and now one of the ancestors, Dick Gregory. He recently passed away. The announcement that I saw was made on Al Sharpton's page under an hour ago. So this is just recent events that have occurred, and I just want to say rest in power. He's definitely an influence to some of the work that I'm doing on stage, and you know, I just you know, I'd hope that if I ever reach old age, I would be as respected and as listened to as a person and as influential as Dick Gregory. So I just wanted to say rest in power to the ancestor. And also to you, Gus, you know, get well soon. Back pain is nothing to play around with. And as we advance in age, sometimes we might need to make use of simple tools and all sorts of contraptions, and maybe even help from other people to do things like move our things. So, you know, get well soon. Do not mess around with your back. That is a real serious, situation that you're looking at. And, you know, just, take it as slow as you need to. And, regarding the violence that took place in Charlottesville, you know, one thing that I've noticed, one thing that I noticed in the response to it is that, you know, the Heather Hare, the person who died, I don't think that there has been that strong of a response from the community of suspected racists in response to this person's death. In fact, even the mother seemed pretty chipper and upbeat about the whole situation from what I saw. And, you know, this could have been the effect of, you know, the whole, I guess, movement atmosphere surrounding her death. But, you know, I just, you know, to me, it, you know, I didn't see the same type of reaction that that I would expect if a non-white person took this individual's life. I think the response that was given to the mentally disabled child who was, or teen or man, I don't know, who was supposedly kidnapped and abused by young people in Chicago, I think that was given more of an extreme reaction
from the community of suspected racists, you know, at large. So I, you know, that was something that I just found very odd about this whole thing. You know, I think that one thing that was demonstrated in Charlottesville is that the opposition, the racists are very serious about what they are doing, and they are willing to take life. I think that's something that should be noted by all victims of racism that are observing these events. And also, you know, watch all of these groups that they're promoting as I'm viewing as they're kind of promoting them as white saviors. I think I've seen multiple outlets brand Antifa as some sort of anti-racist defense force. I just want to say that anti-fascism is not anti-racism. That is anti-fascism. That is a very specific style of government conduct that they're opposing. You know, that is not the system of racism, white supremacy. The few white people who are saying that are, I suspect, are not very serious about ending the system of racism, white supremacy. Just the other day, a suspected racist was on my group and, you know, asked me the question, you know, what can white people do in response to this to help? And I said, hey, you can send me a donation to kensteeleisthegreatest@gmail.com. Send that to my PayPal and, you know, you can just send some money there. I didn't even say a specified amount. But in response, she was just like, hey, how about I buy you a beer? And I said, I don't drink. And, you know, how about I buy you a blunt? And I said, why are you offering me poison instead of money? You know, you could just send me $5. You know, that would be a gesture of goodwill or earnesty. But no, she, you know, was just like, you know, what about Slim Jims? I'm just like, why do you continue to offer me poison? Anyway, so these suspected racists that, you know, frame themselves as opponents of racism, I'm suspecting that they're not very serious at all, and they're just having a lot of fun with this whole thing.
Appreciate that, Mr. Steele. I would have requested help if I were moving my own item, but I was the person supplying the help in this instance. So next time, excuses. That's what I will have ready as to why I cannot help move anything that looks like it's over 15 pounds. Other folks that we have not heard from at all, if you have a hand up, line should be open. Proceed. There are other folks who have a hand up that we've not heard from?
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Oh, yes. Thank you very much, sir. Greetings to us, the hosts, the listeners, and callers. I was thinking about the same thing myself, about how they have the different, I guess, different sides. You have these different labels coming out, like Antifa and Unite the Right and Alt-Right and Alt-Left. I mean, really, the confusion, I think that's what they're trying to go into now, for more confusion. And that term, because like I just tuned in, I listened to a little bit of the audio segment, then I had to go do something, and I came back. But that term, white supremacy, is being used, but I think it's being used in a way that's fragmented, like it's not being applied to every white person, whether it's the people who are like Richard Spencer and alt-right, that seem to be applying the word to that particular group or segment of white people. And I think they're trying to keep it that way so non-white people would think that it's just only that group, and they keep using the name Donald Trump or the president. He's not saying white supremacy, then neo-Nazi, and you know, different other labels that make it seem like they want to really address the issue of racism. But it really doesn't. When, I guess because not only you, Gus, and the people on the line, we have a more acute understanding of racism, but the masses of non-whites, I think, can be easily misled just by those type of terms they keep projecting or they're putting in their propaganda. Like there was a couple of videos that came out this week where one guy was saying that, oh, well, you know, it was video footage of, I guess, some like a black male was chasing him down, and he went into an act of deception, in my opinion. He was like, oh, you know, dude, I'm just here to have fun. Like, he took off his shirt or whatever, and he said, you know, I'm not really, I guess, white power. That's what he used. And then, you know, black male walks off, and I think this was a white person that was behind the camera. You know, he was questioning the white person, and then the white person was like, oh, you know, I'm not really taking it serious, you know, whatever that means. And he said, I just like being offensive. He didn't use the term racist. He kept saying he liked being offensive. So the dude was like, well, so are you here to support racism? And he didn't really answer his question, so he just walks off. And it looked like he had on one of those white polo shirts and the khaki shorts. So I guess he was marching with one of those torches or whatever. So, you know, just like a lot of the terms they keep using. I don't know if anybody heard, I think Mr. Fuller, he had spoke on it on his Wednesday show. And I was thinking about like how he gave his response about they'll be on different sides. They'll make it seem like they're in opposition to it when they'll be racist pretty much everywhere. So I just want people to be mindful of that. Like I do agree with that that point of view that he made, because when a white person, I guess, you know, a white woman has passed away, like that's white supremacy right there. You know, they can project that image, you know, like rest in peace, and she was a victim of white supremacy. And, you know, they can just manipulate the story in all kind of ways. So that's all I wanted to speak on. And shortly after that, a Confederate monument was taken down here in Gainesville, Florida. And it wasn't really no resistance protest or whatever. But, yeah, that's one of the things that happened after that. And that's all I have to say right now. Thank you.
I don't know if people remember. We got you, the caller that just spoke up. Just give me 2 seconds. I don't know if people remember, but I think right towards the end of 2016, I was saying that we need a term for when race soldiers, when they try to act like only these handful of whites here are racists. I don't know if people remember, some of the people that were on some of those calls where I was saying we need a term for that or might be listening now on the with a hand up with their mic open or what have you. But I was saying, because I was seeing that consistently, and it's going to be more of that as long as Trump is in office. I think some whites, Bill Maher and others, they do this on a regular basis. MSNBC, the Young Turks, where it'll be, it's just the Republicans are racist. The conservatives are racist. So alt-right is racist. Donald Trump is racist. Steve Bannon, just them. The rest of us whites, we are cool. If we could just get those knucklehead whites over there to behave, everything would be straight. If y'all just work with us, we'll get this thing taken. That sort of technique of practicing racism, white supremacy is very effective. And that, like I said, I really didn't get to pay attention to very much of anything this week. But my understanding, a white woman died. You all talked about the situation in Charlottesville. Man, oh, man, that's going to be like, if you all remember the civil rights movement, Reverend James Reed, for people who saw Selma, read about what happened in 1965, Viola Luiso, those two white boys that died with James Chaney. They are great. They get a lot of, they are very effective, they being racists, at being able to use these white sacrifices when it looks like a white person might have been harmed in a dispute about racism, white supremacy. Oh my goodness, this was the best white person ever. Was in with the niggers, was fighting for them. They are super effective. I think you just said they will be saying that this suspected race soldier was a victim of white supremacy. That right there causes so much confusion. The male caller, thank you for your patience. Speak or proceed, sir.
Greetings, everyone. Just wanted to ask you, Gus, well, starting off anyway, ask you a brief question. Did you get x-rays?
Of my back?
Yes, sir.
No, sir.
You probably need to. Might be a good idea. Moving on. In other words, in order to be able to see, you know, what may be wrong, maybe more than what you think it is. Moving on. I thought the caller, the previous caller, female caller, asked a good question. My answer would be to her question, it'll be my guess, yes. She will be, they will throw this white woman into that that club of mothers whose child was murdered, in quote unquote, in the name of, I don't know, counter racism, white supremacy, whatever. I can see that happening. What I have witnessed in this week is typical of the white people, like the white people who have been on this program constantly over and over again. A bunch of white people, a small number of white people, who are pretending, are practicing counter-racism and are absolutely doing nothing at all to counter racism and replace it with a system of justice. And they are aware that they're not doing anything. They are aware that what their interest is to gain the honor status or something like that of non-white people, especially non-white black people, that they're doing good. And they actually aren't anything at all. It was something else I was going to say. Moving on, NFL has been broadcast, been advertising this interview with LaDainian Tomlinson constantly. Sounds like the only thing this is going to be is going to be a typical racist attempt to diminish the global system of racism, white supremacy by having a non-white victim tell a slave story, quote unquote, to this. LaDainian Tomlinson just was inducted into the NFL Hall of Fame, if you know who I'm talking about. And he has repeatedly been talking about this story about he being a descendant of this slave and slave plantation where he grew up on, and he actually met some of the present day white suspected racist ancestors of the people who owned his family. And he also mentioned in his Hall of Fame induction speech. There was something else that I was going to mention about. Okay, I've mentioned about the question of the caller. That's it. When it comes up in my mind, I'll be able to say it later on. Thank you.
Appreciate that, retired firefighter. I know LaDainian Tomlinson, he was a part of, I guess, the publicity push for the book Tomlinson Hill, The Remarkable Story of Two. This came out in 2014, which is about exactly what retired firefighter just said, that his LaDainian, the football player, LaDainian Tomlinson's family allegedly is descended from this group of slaves gone to Texas. Folks remember Edward Baptist, the half has never been told. But his family allegedly, they were enslaved in Texas and grew up there. And it's all in this book that was written by a white man, Chris Tomlinson. And I think LaDainian Tomlinson, I think, is included on the audiobook if you check that out. It's, yeah, you can do your own investigating if you want some more research. Other folks that we've not heard from, if you have a hand up, line should be open. Proceed.
Hello?
Yes, ma'am.
Hi, thank you so much for taking my call. I'm sorry you're not feeling 100%. I hope you feel better soon. Good clips. I guess one clip that struck me was about the young black people missing, and especially the children, in contrast to, I believe it was last week, when the young lady was looking for a child, and all of a sudden she was an unfit mother and all these things. So it's like, if you do the right thing, it doesn't work. If you don't do it, then, you know, they don't care. So, again, we have to figure out solutions to take care of our children, not just biological, but our children. They are making that, yeah, the lady that passed away, I'm sorry she died, but a lot of people got hit. She just happened to die. And, of course, it's bad, it's horrible, but, you know, it was... His act to me, it was bad, but it was more random than Dylan Storm Roof, and they still haven't called these people white supremacist thugs. I might hear the word loser every now and then. Oh, you should denounce the Nazis, blah, blah, blah. But of course, they're not thugs, only black people are thugs. And Ken Steele, that was a wonderful request to ask for money, and you always get that kind of answer. I think I told last year how I went to the church and they asked for solutions. I said, pay me. They looked at me like I was nuts. So, yeah, it's a good way to really see that they don't care. And I work at a university, and because the Charlottesville incident happened, like you said, near University of Virginia, we've been getting a lot of emails. They've been talking about it, be careful, blah, 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 all this kind of stuff. And somebody asked me, they go, why do we keep getting this? I go, well, that happened at a college town. And the main thing going on in our town is this college. She's like, oh. So if you do work at a university, I'm sure you've talked about it or had someone tell you to read something about it and talk about it. It's, of course, it's sad what happened, but it's another white supremacist incident. And, you know, until something happens to them, as we can see, then they start to talk a little bit more. But, oh, this has been happening for years, and they've been rising for years. Black people have been telling you that for years. And in addition, of course, the ultimate acts of racism, well, not ultimate, but other acts of racism I've seen, especially on the political shows and CNN, they pit two black people against each other and have them go at it. How could you support Trump, blah, blah, blah. And the only thing these other people to me should say is, well, don't you work at a racist institution? If black people stop working for racists, most of them won't have jobs at all. So, you know, don't hype me. The real enemy is not me. Thank you.
Context of white supremacy. Other folks that we've not heard from at all. Do we have people who have a hand up that we've not heard from at all yet? Oh, did we get everybody? I certainly hope folks are not spectating with all of the nonsense that went down this week. Did the Charlottesville, since we didn't get to do workplace racism, did the Charlottesville situation come up on the job for anyone this week where you were forced to give commentary?
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Yes, sir. Thanks for allowing me to speak. It did come up on my job, and I just, like, when I thought about it, you know, in the aftermath of it, I just basically said, and many of the white people agreed with me, I just said, well, I said this issue was going on because, you know, we don't really talk about it. You know, I didn't really give my opinion on racism. I just said, you know, I just think this still is an issue because we simply don't speak about it. And I don't think we should talk about it here at work. But, you know, that, you know, in a general sense, basically, you know, we don't really speak on it. But other people were saying, like, how the Confederate monument was taken down, like, right up the street. It was a girl that was saying how she didn't agree with it because I guess she supports it or whatever. But I guess, you know, she didn't really get too upset about it being taken down because I don't know where the statue was moved to. There was one person that was saying that, I guess, when I was in the break room, another non-white person was looking at, I guess, CNN. And I don't know if anybody on the line has heard any white people refer to it as communist news network. Like, a lot of white people use that term, like commies and communists, you know, I guess, to make a pun or whatever when they're talking about CNN. So maybe their favorite network is Fox News. So that's pretty much as that I know about it right now. But mainly, of course, they're showing sympathy for the white woman that was killed. And it seemed like that's the thing that they are centering on mainly. So that was my encounter with that this past week.
Appreciate that. One of our other callers down in the Florida area. Did we have any folks that we missed completely or folks that wanted to respond to that query about if you had to deal with the Charlottesville situation on the job this week?
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
I did not get commentary on the job. I did get commentary from taking time off my job to see a doctor who brought it up. I had to see a new doctor. My previous doctor moved, and so she was going to transfer me to her colleague. I found her, by the way, through the National Medical Association, which is an association specifically for black physicians, and I also found my dentist through the National Dental Association, which is an association specifically for black dentists. Just some information. Well, my doctor wasn't able to leave me with her colleague, who was also black. So doctor comes in, white woman, very short. I'm much bigger in stature than she is. And she was jovial and courteous and polite. And she asked me why my blood pressure was so high. It was 168 over 50. And so I told her, I said, I work with the Klan. And she had this look on her face, which I actually do. There are people who talk about it specifically at the job, and there are some people who have tattoos that signify that they are in it at my work location. And then some conversation commenced, and I asked her why I wasn't able to get another doctor who was black. And the look on her face changed a little bit, but the conversation continued, and she said that she unfortunately did her residency in Charlottesville, and she thought that the things that were going on were very unfortunate. And she giggled and joked nervously like they often do when they're really not serious about the topic of racism. So that was how I encountered that subject matter.
Interesting. Yeah, it would depend on the mood the person caught me in. If I was feeling well and cared to bring up, oh yeah, I'm very familiar with that area, to see where they would try to take the conversation. Any other folks wanted to respond to that question?
May I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Peace to you, Gus. Peace to everyone listening. Gus, the back back pain is nothing to play around with. So, man, my heart really goes out to you. That's a metaphor.
I really feel bad for you. I hope you recover quickly and swiftly so you can get back to the work that you love doing. Charlottesville. It actually did come up at work. One day I was working on a line. I work production, so I was working on a production line where I was the only black male. And immediately when we arrived on the line, started setting everything up so we could actually start producing the product, a 25-year-old male who I know and I've talked with outside of work several times said, quote, "Well, seems like a good day to get fired. Anyone want to talk about Charlottesville?" He looked right at me. I said, I've heard enough about it. I don't really need to. This was Thursday, if memory serves me correctly. And he proceeded to make some comments about it that he thought that it was an interesting conflict about the statues coming down and should come down. He argued, as did another woman who writes when she's not at work. She's an author. She has been published several times, particularly articles. She's tried to publish a couple of books. I know this because she has talked to me about it numerous times. But he argued, and she argued with him or on his behalf, that the statues serve an important historical point, that they should be allowed to stay up simply because they tell the story that black people need them to tell, that once upon a time, this group of people believed so mightily in owning black people that they fought to separate from the country, and we should not forget that. I told her, because they were really pushing me to make a comment. So I told her, it doesn't matter to me if the statues come down or if they stay up. It doesn't change my life if they come down. If they stay up, it doesn't change my life either. So for a moment, everything died down, which is another metaphor. For a moment, everybody went back to work. And probably 10 minutes later, the conversation started up again. I don't really recall how it happened. I was building parts at the time. I wasn't paying attention. And then the topic of lynching somehow was brought up. And that piqued my interest when I heard the word lynch. And the comments that were made surrounding it was they didn't understand why black people found it so terrible. It wasn't terrible. They didn't say terrible, but they didn't understand why black people made such a big deal of it when white people had been lynched. And again, I surmised that they were all trying to push me to make an inappropriate statement. This has happened before at this place, where people try to instigate me into making some sort of statement where they can then report me. I didn't jump into the conversation. So finally, this woman, this writer, walked up to me and said, "You know, I really want to know one thing. If the statues were to stay up, would it really..." I forgot how she asked the question, but basically, would it really change, or not change, but would it really impact white supremacy, was basically what she was asking. And I told her, probably not. She said, "Well, you know, I really think that they should leave it up, and they should leave it up because..." I'm trying to think of the exact words that she said. She made the statement that it was illegal, basically, to take them down, that they had been put up once, so they should remain up. And I simply said to her, "I believe there was an ordinance that was passed that allowed statues to be built. Now, therefore, there's an ordinance that has been passed and debated that is now possibly going to take them down. It's just law. And she said, quote, well, that mayor should be lynched if he allows those statues to come down. And she walked away. Enough said. I just stood there, turned around, and started building again. That, it didn't come up again that day. Thank you. I'll mute my line.
Workplace racism. Hold on 1 second, Mr. Steele. I just want to say quickly, workplace racism is on Thursdays at 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific. We should be back this coming Thursday. Things continue in the correct direction. We should be back for this coming Thursday evening. Then we'll have more time to focus on this subject specifically. I do think it's very important. When you started your synopsis of what happened, you said that this suspected race soldier came in and said, hey, it's like a good day, you know, for someone to lose their job or something pretty close to that. And I think you also, it seemed like that you were speculating that this could have been some sort of setup, a planned attempt to get you, to provoke you to say something so that you could be terminated. Racists do that sort of thing all the time, particularly on the job, where we talk about this regularly. They talk to one another. They could have texted one another, emailed, whatever it is, and set this up in advance. We're going to come in the next day. We're going to talk about the Charlottesville situation, see if we can get him riled up. Maybe he'll chimp out, and then we can get him fired. And if, you know, maybe we need to, we'll try him in the morning. If it doesn't work, we'll come back and try him again in the afternoon, that sort of thing. The other, with the comment that the female made at the end, I would just write that down about the mayor needing to be lit. Write that down, store that away. Great. That could be something even 5 years from now that you can pull out and use to your advantage. Mr. Steele? Mr. Steele, are you still with us, sir? Maybe he's not in an area
where the phone was on mute.
Oh, okay.
Okay. Yeah, I too would make the same statement or a similar statement regarding the last statement that was made by the lady. That right there is a very, to me, very threatening remark, and I would not take that. I would take that remark very seriously. I would have made note of the conversation that took place prior to that comment being made. I would, as best I can, in any situation that's very similar to that, I would begin writing down in my little notes. And if you live in a state where you are allowed to record people, I would suggest recording people as well. That taking place on the job, that's 100% completely unacceptable. I don't care what industry that you're in, that type of language being expressed needs to be written down and reported. And I would suggest if you are feeling like this is something that has repeated itself over time, I would suggest telling a lawyer about it, and finding a lawyer that handles employment law and becoming very good friends with that person, because you can find out a lot of information that could be very beneficial to you, and you can find situations where you can profit off of all of these very racist remarks that are being made by suspected white supremacists at your place of employment.
Appreciate that, Mr. Steele. Did we have other folks who wanted to comment? If there were people who were going to respond to the question about whether the Charlottesville situation came up on the job, or if you had, I guess, your own observations, commentary you want to share, that's fine too. But either or, if you have a hand up, line should be open. Proceed.
Hello,
Can I be heard again?
Yes, sir.
No, it didn't come up around me anyway. But added to what I was talking about before, I heard the name John Brown came up quite a few times during this week also, and from hearing it, it almost gave me the feeling of nausea, because it's a repeated strategy, I call it, on and on and on again. I could be wrong, but I doubt very seriously that this white woman even expected that deadly consequences would have taken place. She was enjoying herself, much like that white woman that has been on the program, that has been also joining those protesters. And she didn't even know what hit her, because I doubt very seriously that they expect that the consequences were going to be deadly. Yeah, those are just some of my additional thoughts that I forgot before. And yeah, that's it. Thank you.
May I be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
Thank you for allowing me to speak again. I don't know if echo is a metaphor or not, but I definitely agree with the retired firefighter's comments. I actually heard, I was watching the news, and I did hear that this Heather woman was compared to the Viola, or the other white woman who was participating in the Freedom Riders thing.
Viola Louisa.
And it was, thank you, Viola Louisa. She was already compared to her, and it has been kind of like, I've definitely been very confused. And also, I did listen to Mr. Fuller's program on Wednesday, and I was thinking about that same statement that one of the previous male callers had made. But even her statement, even Heather's statement, where apparently one of her last posts on Facebook was, if you're not outraged by this, something about being outraged by it, then, you know, I'm sorry, I don't have the information, like the post right in front of me. But it kind of seemed like you can either be outraged about these statues coming down, or you can be outraged by racism. But it was not completely explained, you know, her true intentions. And then also I read, it was on heavy.com. I'm not quite sure how credible people think that is. I don't really think too highly. I don't, you know, have a great opinion of them, but they said that she got hit crossing the street. So I feel like with the news, what I've been seeing on the major news outlets, MSNBC, CNN, and I even watched Fox commentary, you know, to laugh, of course, but it's almost being presented like, you know, she was in front of the car trying to stop him, not like she was just crossing the street and just so happened to be hit. So I feel like it's definitely very decisive, and of course, as it always is. I just wanted to add that. Thank you.
The quote.
And also, I'm sorry.
I was just going to make sure. Folks,
I apologize.
Had the quote, and then you can add whatever you want. Read the quote is: "If you're not outraged, you're not paying attention." That they're attributing her last social media post from Heather Hare. Did you have more, Red?
Yes. Thank you. I just wanted to say that I actually work at home, so I didn't
you know, say anything to anybody else about my comments about the Charlottesville. And but I did comment because actually on Thursday, a few people who typically call in, we still called in and we kind of had our own little workplace racism. And I know some people did mention, I think Thomas from New York, he did actually call in, and a few of us were all talking. But I know at my job, at least, they do typically have news on all the different TV monitors. But what I had came to notice was that they, whenever something is controversial, whether it's like about gay rights or you know, racism, what have you, they will put it on some talk show, like, you know, like Regis and Kelly or something like that. But I wanted to add that. That's all. Thank you.
That's funny. Wow. The one thing also that I noticed with the Charlottesville thing, they were making it seem like Charlottesville is being made to look bad, like the city's reputation is, you know, being marred, is being blemished with this incident, and making it seem as though this is a town full of racists. And they were like, oh man, nothing could be further from the truth. This is a quaint little liberal college town, and the whole city is like a shrine to Thomas Jefferson, and these are farmers. And you heard some of that in the clip, and I was like, wait a minute, didn't they just have that black student at the University of Virginia? You all remember they beat him bloody. Alcohol was involved. They were out on the corner. And this was like 2014. This was really recent that he got thrown down. This was right after Michael Brown Jr. and all that that happened at UVA. I went to school there. I remember quite a few. In fact, all you have to do is bring up, go anywhere in the vicinity of Charlottesville and bring up, oh, yeah, I think Thomas Jefferson raped Sally Hemings, and see if you think it is a liberal, quaint, progressive, open-minded town of whites. They do that sort of thing on a regular basis. And they were talking to some of the residents there, and I was like, this is absurd. Nothing could, I mean, you can just stroll the campus. You don't even have to go any further than that, of the University of Virginia, built by enslaved black people who were probably being raped as well by Thomas Jefferson, and get the feeling just absurd. Like I said, it was terrible this week to be injured with all this going down right in an area that I know very well. Other folks have commentary they wanted to make sure they got in?
Folks. Can I be heard?
Yes, sir, Mr. Steele.
You know, any time that there is any of these, I guess, extreme, violent, outward expressions of racism that goes on that can't be ignored by the public at large. Anytime that this happens, I've noticed that there is a torrent of videos and news reports about suspected white supremacists that are joining victims of racism in the fight against racism. And, you know, they come in a few different formats. You know, there's the anti-racist redneck. It's usually some sort of fat or poor-looking white person that is, you know, saying some very conventional truths about racism, white supremacy, and framing themselves and, you know, I guess a number of other white people as, you know, allies. And, you know, these videos confuse victims of racism a lot. And, you know, they're widely disseminated. The newest one that I've seen is the white football player who joined the victim of racism in the protest against, I guess, racism at this point. I guess it's explicitly everybody's protesting racism now. That is a hip thing. The new thing is to have them, you know, put their arm around a black person who is protesting, not actively protesting themselves, but putting their arm around or touching. And there's this one photo of an NFL player, I guess, putting his hand down on a victim of racism on his team, who is kneeling. And, you know, the image that is being disseminated looks strikingly similar to the Emancipator statues that they have of Abraham Lincoln. You should, you know, go ahead and take a look at some of these pictures. The resemblance, I don't think, is lost on the people taking the photograph, and I don't think is lost on the people who are sharing the photograph either. So, you know, just, again, be very, very, very suspicious of these suspected racists and what they're doing in response to the extreme violence that took place last weekend. I just have a suspicion that they're just, you know, setting the environment up for them to go even harder next time. Thank you.
Right on. I know that segment on not related to Charlottesville, the segment that dealt with Alzheimer's disease and black people being more susceptible to that, allegedly, the report that they did down in, and the eclipse is coming up. I forgot all about that. All of the hubbub. I don't know what people are in the path of the eclipse, but here in Seattle, we're pretty close to Oregon, and Oregon is right in the, I think, range where you can see 100% visibility for the eclipse. So I think we are going to check that out on Monday. I was thinking it's going to be kind of crowded. They've been saying for weeks, months, really, that Oregon is going to be overrun. They're expecting like 1 million people to flood into the state for Monday. So that's generally the sort of thing that I am not interested in hanging out, especially if it's going to be a lot of white people, which I would anticipate it being for Oregon. But the eclipse is going down. I do think we're going to participate. I will try to take notes. If other folks are participating or have commentary on that, that would be grand as well, since that has also garnered a lot of attention over the past year or so in these parts. But also wanted to get in that clip on Alzheimer's. I thought it was important because just that was something that I hadn't thought about in terms of having connections to other people, and that being one of the results of racial dislocation when they come in and boot out all the black people and you lose those connections to other people that you're around and having other folks to talk to, and how that can even have an impact on your health. That was something I just had not considered, but I thought that, and then in connection with the piece from StoryCorps, where what exactly would an older black person be remembering under the system of white supremacy, and this is what she recalls from age 5. It reminded me of one of my favorite books, Isabel Wilkerson, The Warmth of Other Suns, where she said that a lot of the black people that she talked to, Ida Mae Gladney and these folks, Dr. Thomas Pershing Foster, they said that they hadn't talked about some of the things that she wrote in the book for 30, 40 years. They hadn't told anybody about these things because a lot of that stuff was really, really traumatic and painful to have to relive that. That is the system of white supremacy. But I did think those segments were very important. I don't know if folks got to hear them or had commentary there or not. Did anyone with the eclipse, is anyone going to check that out? Anybody in the path of that for this coming Monday?
I figured maybe. I would just see it happening. People would tell me that it's happening. I didn't think it was that big of an event.
The female caller?
I'm actually not tuning in, but it's funny that you asked, because my relative, they're actually driving from Ohio to Nashville. I guess that's supposed to be another place where it's supposed to have really good visibility. I didn't know that it was something that it was extremely serious to drive and to go out of state to see. But that's what I wanted to add.
I didn't either. I didn't think it was that serious. It seemed like I did note that white people were investing a lot of time and energy. They had a campaign. I guess you all could do it too. But it's called Citizen Scientist, where they train people where they give you the equipment. They want to go out and record the eclipse from as many different angles as possible so that they can study. Again, Mr. Fuller, when he said they will go to the bottom of the ocean or the top of the known universe to study, all in the name of strengthening global domination over non-white people. But I saw a lot of that where they were investing a lot of time and energy studying. And what can we learn from this? And why is this so important? Like, it was greatly on display over the past week or so. And like, I would not have paid that much attention. I think even in Washington State, they don't have 100% visibility here, but it's still pretty good, I guess, since it's pretty close. But I will report back on the chaos from Oregon if there is any. Anybody else? Eclipse? Anybody else? No.
May I be heard?
Yes, sir.
I apologize. I had to get some place where it was actually quiet. On the eclipse, this is V from Central New York. On the eclipse, several years ago, I think I was in high school, actually, so about 20 years ago. I read a book on eclipse. I was on eclipses and their impact on the planet. And I think possibly some of the interest by white people towards eclipses is because scientifically they believe that eclipses have a impact on the actions of other people who live on the planet. I don't know how true it is, but that is what the book suggested, and that scientists have measured certain catastrophes, certain uprisings, even certain movements according to eclipses or partial eclipses. Again, don't know how true it is, but the fact that so many white people are paying attention, it sort of does make me wonder if they believe it's true. On another topic, Gus, I don't know if I can quickly make a statement about one of the clips.
Proceed.
Okay. The clip about the missing black girls. I am so glad that you played that clip. About 10 years ago, I was in college, and for a public speaking course, I put together a presentation on this very topic. However, I didn't just speak of black girls, I said black people in general. And I utilized the media coverage that Elizabeth Smart gained in contrast to the media coverage, non-media coverage, really, that a young girl named Precious Doe received. And the class, I was in the class, I was the only black guy. And it was actually received pretty well by my peers. However, we had a 15 minute limit. And I went over the 15 minutes by about 3 minutes and probably would have went another 2 minutes just to conclude when my professor angrily told me to, quote, wrap it up. I think you said enough. And forced me, of course, to quickly end it. And, I ended up receiving a B- on that presentation. The rest of my presentations, I received all A's. That, though, was the only one I did about racism, and I received a B-. I hope something spectacular comes from the awareness and the publicizing of missing black children and the lack of media attention that they receive. Specifically, I hope black people band together to start forming organizations and such to track down these children, or to at least make their names much more publicly known. Thank you very much, and I'll mute my line.
I have heard that pattern with other black scholars where they do exemplary work and then they attempt to do one report where they're kind of mentioning racism, and then all of a sudden they have almost been flunked out of school. I've heard that repeatedly. And I wrote about missing black girls earlier this year, the case in Washington, D.C. And in hearing that clip, I did not know the late Gwen Ifill. We read her book, The Breakthrough, that was her. She, in terms of the missing white woman syndrome, that was her that came up with that phrasing. Rest in peace, Gwen Ifill, from the book club. Do we have other folks who had commentary they wanted to make sure they got in, news clips or other? There were lots of things that went down this week. Can't play everything in the news clips. Oh, I guess I can give out the number in case folks are spectating, waiting until the very last moment to chime in. The number again, 641-715-3640, and the code 564-943-pound. Press star 6 if you would like to participate. We have about 20 minutes, a little less than 20 minutes left in the broadcast. Folks have commentary they want to make sure they got in.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
I believe it was Red from Ohio that brought up some of the conversation that we had during the workplace racism that we still decided to have conversation about. And the topic of propaganda came up. I believe it was myself. Well, it was myself. I believe it was also Thomas in New York. And we were speaking about how propaganda began with a man by the name of Edward Bernays, who was the nephew of Sigmund Freud, who is the modern father of modern psychology. And what Edward Bernays saw how useful psychological warfare was during World War I, and decided to study it and use it for what he said was peaceful purposes, and called it public relations. And from that moment forward, the modern advertising and marketing in this country comes from that ideology, which is used to use media in all of its forms to control perceptions and images of people. There was a documentary about it, the origins of this, called The Century of Self. The first one called The Happiness Machines, which speaks about how to get white people to fight white supremacy. So, and the reason I bring this up is there's a lot of things going on specifically around Charlottesville where the terminology, the stories, how they're being told, have a very specific kind of pattern that reminds me of how propaganda began and how it is used and how it is used to confuse. So if there are any victims of racism who want to be more educated on how propaganda is used, it was productive for me to study on these things. That it was just productive for me. I'm not sure about everybody else. But so when I see certain images, I'm reminded. Being well informed is just very helpful. So I just thought I'd add that bit of information, and then I'll mute my line.
May I be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
I'm sorry. I just wanted to say, just to the previous caller, I did actually take your recommendation. I was on the call as well with you all, and I did see The Century of Self, and I thought that it, of course, there were still the white people who made the documentary. I did see that they were practicing racism, but it also helped me to understand that white people will kill non-whites for absolutely, of course, we know that I know that they'll kill them for absolutely nothing. But it more so along the lines that, like he said, they use propaganda to convince other people. It helped me to better understand, why they, with the oil in Iraq and calling, Iraqi people terrorists. They did that before with South America, with the bananas, and they
you know, killed people because this American company wanted to continue to sell bananas to white people. So it definitely helped me to get more clarity. So I just wanted to say thank you. That's all.
Right on.
You are welcome. I'm glad that you got something productive out of it, and I want to also say you are correct. That documentary was produced by white people suspected racist in, you know, any form of media, even if it can be educational. Victims of racism, white supremacy, always look at the source. So that you will no longer, or you won't be further confused. I tend to be hesitant when I share things that are productive for me, because I'm not sure how well educated other victims are, and if that information will be more confusing to them. But I'm glad that you got something productive out of it.
Winding down, if folks have a final comment they want to make sure they get in for anything that took place over the past 7 days, if we missed you totally. Thomas in New York, did you have commentary? Are you just listening? I don't know if you were trying to get to a quiet spot on the plantation or if you had commentary. Thomas in New York, did you have commentary?
Hey, Gus, how you doing? No, you know, my pressure was so high all day, so I was in and out. I'm off work tonight. I just have some observations, of course. I just came back from vacation. You know, I'm glad to hear your voice, Gus. I called in the workplace racism, and you weren't there. I was worried. You know, I didn't see you post anything, and, you know, I'm worried for you up there in Seattle, Gus. You know, you don't have a lot of ethnicity up there. You know, something happened to you. You know, we wouldn't even know what happened, you know. So I'm glad to hear your voice, brother. Oh, should I say that? My friend Gus. Just came back from vacation, and first, you know, I wanted to say, you know, it's one thing when you go away, and I didn't go far, just a 3-hour drive away, but when you see a bunch of white people and in a beach type environment. You know, they're just so colorful. And what I observed was white women, what we call them here, you know, poom-poom shorts or coochie cutters or Daisy Dukes, but wear these shorts. And they don't have the body for it. And I just, like, wonder if this is a psychological thing, like by them putting on these little shorts, do they think that, you know, their butt got bigger or something, or... You know, it just was like very, very strange. And then white men in these big monstrous pickup trucks. I would say more than 50% of the white men was driving a pickup truck. And you know, I was wondering if that was a complex too. You know, you being at their, you know, the most weaker of the genetic lines, it's just like them getting in this big truck to hype up themselves. You know, it's just very strange. And I was in the Jersey Shore, and the amount of every T-shirt, you know, when you go to a boardwalk, there's T-shirt spots where they, you know, sort of like the type of place that the people in the Jersey Shore was working at. When they were on the boardwalk, and all these T-shirt spots have these a bunch of Confederate flag like logos, you know, with different sayings. One, if this flag offends you, then get out of my country, you know, things like that. But it was just very, very odd for that to be. In Jersey, you know, like it, last time I was there, which was about 3 years ago, you didn't see any of that type of stuff, but it's the time we're in. I wanted to speak about Charlottesville, and some of the things the gentleman was just talking about is how the media, you know, is playing a lot of, they're being very deceptive. First, I wanted to say that the so-called anti-white protesters, they don't represent black people. They represent different communities of white people from whom they oppose the alt-right. But, you know, these groups are like the LGBT groups, the white feminist groups, the Jews, the white sections of the Black Lives Matter groups. Now, this is what I hate how they spin it. Now, however, the white supremacists that were protesting the statue of the Confederate General Lee being taken down, now, this is a, they're protesting a statue being taken down of a Confederate general who was upholding slavery, which has nothing to do with white LGBT, white feminists, white Jews, or White Lives Matter, or, I mean, Black Lives Matter, the white part of it, which lets me think that this is just a white, another way of white people playing victim. You're not the victim in this, you know, LGBTs and white feminists, but why are you there? You know, why are you the ones on TV trying to play the victim? General Lee has nothing to do with you. Also, the whites, they make like it seem like this white so-called hatred just came from nowhere. All the newscasters, like it's not coming from their communities. These aren't their neighbors, their coworkers, their fellow church members. They make it seem like white supremacists are the only people marching here. The bad people are the Nazis, the skinheads, the KKK. But and they keep calling them white nationalists. And what's a white nationalist other than a racist? I don't know why they don't just call them racist. I really hate that white nationalist word because white isn't a nationality; it's a race. American is the nationality. So is you know, they're white. These white nationalists, where did they come from? Like, they're making it seem like these people just popped out of nowhere. Once again, now the black TV personalities with their commentary on this is very confusing. Whites don't empathize with blacks, as we know if you listen to the crowds, you know. They don't empathize with us, so Van Jones crying on TV and, you know, people having fits and all these teachable for white moments. Just a bunch of confusion. I wish black people would have stayed away from this on television and just let the white people talk about it. And the last thing I wanted to say is I see now that Bannon has stepped down, they're trying to make the spin like this was all because of North Korea comments he made. Not to do with the fact that we have all these race rallies everywhere, and he's one of the main people behind it, his Breitbart, and he's in the White House, and, you know, the president, so-called, is trying to save a little face, so, of course, he has to go. I don't know why they're trying to spin it like this has anything other to do than these race rallies. And, Gus, I'll mute my line. Thank you for taking my call.
Right on. Other folk, we have less than 10 minutes. So if you have commentary, I guess you'd have to be brief, right to the point with what it is you would like to say in the last few minutes. Anybody have final comments they want to get in before we conclude?
I'll just make the suggestion on how I stay focused when I'm listening to white people who say that they are committed to something that they identify as anti-racist, if many different terms that goes along with it. Mr. Fuller, to me, brought up the idea of 9 areas of activity. Now, I don't know the answer on solving the problem of racism and white supremacy. But I do know that in those 9 areas of activity are going to be a part of the answer as far as repairing those nine areas of activities. I don't even hear not a white person even talking about anything that got to do with anything of repairing the problems that was created by the system of racist white supremacy in none of those nine areas of activity. As we know, education, economics, entertainment, labor law, politics, sex, and war. I may have skipped some of them, but the nine areas of activity. I don't even hear anybody, any of those white people who pretending that they are practicing counter-racism or even talking about those subjects, let alone talking about repairing the damage that white people have done over centuries of those nine areas of activity. And that's basically how I stay focused on what is being said. And as I mentioned before, my grade on the subject with white people is an F in their so-called attempted practices. That's it.
Appreciate that, retired firefighter. Any other concluding remarks? We have about six minutes left. Any other remarks folks want to make sure they got in?
Just one last thing I make to say is, and the most important thing is, let's not forget that both sides of this, these are all white supremacists. I don't care if you're marching or chanting Black Lives Matter or whatever that they're marching on. If you're marching with black people, those are white supremacists. These are white people are fighting with other white people about how they're going to treat black people going forward. Some people are for going back to, it's sort of like the Ben Tillman book, because bringing this stuff up, ironically, with Donald Trump as the president. A reconstruction of white supremacy. Some people want to go back to the Tillman way. Some people want to keep it this way. Some people are saying that, hey, these niggas are replacing us. If they're getting too much power, the other ones are like, really? Are you serious? We got half of them in jail. We can keep them from getting jobs and loans, we're gentrifying them, and they're clashing. And this has nothing to do with us. This has everything to do with us, but this. Either side, neither one of them are going to be on our side at the end of the day. They're just trying to figure out how they're going to treat us going forward. I don't know if that makes sense, but it's like watching your demise taking place on, you know, right in front of your eyes in a way. And I just really wish that we would, black people in general, would stay away from these rallies and not participate in it, just sit back and watch.
Thomas in New York.
Can I be heard?
Just wanted to get in really quick. I know Dr. Welsing, she was a big advocate of that. This was years ago, the grandsister, Dr. Welsing. Matter of fact, this was in the middle of that kerfuffle with Ferguson and all that, 2014. She said then that she did not support black people going out to any event. I think she even put a number on it. I think she said if it's 10 or more people, she would recommend not being present. She thinks that would just be really easy. And whites, they have a variety of ways that they could say, oh, man, we thought we had a gun or anything, and anything could happen. Another person could drive into a crowd of people just to stay away. You can watch, observe, take notes, and learn. But I think her advice would definitely apply to what's happening right now. Proceed, Mr. Steele.
Just wanted to say regarding the media coverage surrounding this the reaction to this situation that took place in Virginia, man, the black males that they've had on the cable networks have been I guess showcased in a way where they are being very, very emotional you know, overly emotional about this. I, you know, me personally, I speak with victims of racism about these matters all the time, and you know, in person and online, and I have yet to run into a single victim of racism that has shed a single tear regarding the goings on in Virginia. Yet on TV, there are multiple examples of black males crying about this. Just very disappointing to see. You know, I make it a point not to watch too much cable news, but some of it seeps its way into my news feed, and I see some of these clips. You know, I saw a clip of what's his name, the one with the hair, his name eludes me at the moment, but he was saying, you know, calling all these white supremacists brother, and he was saying that we needed, you know, the help of quote anarchists. He was saying, and protesters were he said that they saved his life. You know, I'm just wondering, what is this older gentleman doing at this demonstration? Or, you know, what good is, you know, he doing by being at these events? And why is he endlessly asking for the support and help of suspected racists to be you know, instrumental in whatever solution that he wants to bring about? So that's just something that I noticed in the media coverage. Just a lot of black males acting like females. I don't know. Very, very very suspicious.
We will wrap there. That'll be something to pay attention to. I think you might have been referencing Dr. Cornel West, if I were to make a guess, but I haven't seen a lot of the news coverage. I do know anything on television, I would already be suspicious to the degree that I think racists are involved, and I would pretty much suspect that they are involved if it's happening. But yeah, it's very, very easy for racists to go grab any victim of racism, white supremacy, just go snatch any random black person and, you know, look here, you're going to get on and cry about this white woman who died in Charlottesville in the next 5 seconds, or, you know, we'll make it tough on you, or whatever. Or they could be nice about, hey, come do this and cry, you know, we might have a TV show for you, or anything. They got lots of ways that you can do it when you are dominating. With that, you just have to check Black Talk Radio Network. I think some people had said that the broadcast we did last week on Tuesday with Joseph Gibson, Why Nobody Wants to Teach Black Kids, that they saw it posted in iTunes, but it wasn't playing. I'll double check to see if there's an issue. I know it is available on Black Talk Radio Network, and it is playing there. I checked it. The archive is there. It's also at YouTube, lots of different places, but I will double check the iTunes feed just to see if there's a problem and anything I can do to expedite that. But if you have other questions, guest suggestions, problems, gripes, drop an email untiljustice@gmail.com. My email is a little backlogged because of the health problem I've had over the last 10 days, 10, 12 days. But as I'm feeling better, I will be catching up on my email. So feel free, untiljustice@gmail.com. I will drop a line if we do indeed check out the eclipse on Monday in Oregon. Probably around lots of whites, but I'll let folks know how it unfolds. Remain safe if you go or not. Remain safe as we wind down summer of 2017. Sobriety would be best under conditions of white supremacy. Get out, frolic, have a blast. I'm trying to see if we can go to the beach to watch the eclipse Monday morning, but I don't think being under the influence would be to our advantage. There's a lot of evidence. Race soldiers, they have throttled, terrorized, abused black people and had an easier time doing so in many instances when we were intoxicated and just not able to make the best decisions to take care of ourselves. So let's try to keep that in mind, not make it easy for the likes of Daniel Holdsclaw, Darren Wilson, to continue to brutalize and kill and brutalize us. Let's stick to being sober. That's it.
Creator, we ask that you help us remain patient with other black people, victims of white supremacy. We ask that you help us remain patient with ourselves. Remind us to demonstrate the highest levels of black self-respect at all times, in all places, each and every time we are in contact with another black person. It has been time. Replace white supremacy with justice immediately. Cal signing out. Thanks all for tuning in.
Nigga, you so brainwashed.
I'm a victim,
your
brother.
Problem. You're a victim.
I'm a victim of 400 years of conditioning.
Shut up.
The man has programmed my conditioning.
Mm-hmm.
Even my conditioning has been conditioned.